across the UK, online and on DAB. The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment. For those about to talk, we salute you.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
So, I was about to start the show by saying two things, but I've already thought three or four or five, so I don't think I'll bother to enumerate them. The first thing is that the terrible events in America we are monitoring, and if there is anything that needs updating on those terrible events, then we will bring you that straight away. Rest assured of that. The second thing is that in the second hour of the programme, from 11 o'clock, we're going to be discussing dementia, which is very much becoming the third way. What I mean by that is that you don't have to go back terribly far to a time in everybody's family's life when an elderly relative was departing. It would either happen suddenly or very slowly due to a physical condition. But now there is this third way whereby a person goes but remains alive. And so many things to consider in all of that. And between 11 and 12, we're going to be doing that on this show. And I just want to mark your card now and say that if dementia is something that you're dealing with in your family, or you believe you're about to be dealing with or have dealt with, if it's possible to deal with it, then we would very much welcome your views. You might like to construct an email, because it's definitely something that you can't squeeze into a text for obvious reasons. And you may not feel like coming to the phone, but if you do want to come to the phone and talk about your experiences, your first-hand experiences, we're not going to be talking to experts or doctors. We're going to be talking to people who have direct experience of dementia underneath their own roof. That's from 11 until 12. But in this first part of the programme, looking at the big domestic news of the day, I've got two things. How many is that then altogether? Four, five. Two things on the big domestic stories of the day. And the first is this. And I don't want to be overly cute about this, but we've had the Labour Party at their conferences in Brighton saying that capitalism is failing, or capitalism is dead. And, of course, the Conservative Party, the government, have come to the aid of capitalism and said that we've got it to thank for everything. But I'm just beginning to wonder, and I'm not going to overstress this point, because it's basically just kind of cute. Is it not possible that Jeremy Corbyn, and where he has got to now in the state of the nation, is actually the embodiment of the capitalist message? Because Jeremy now offers the country choice. And it's not that long ago, you will remember this, when we were all moaning about the fact that the main parties were all the same. When Tony Blair's New Labour looked very much like the Conservative Party that David Cameron was coming to lead, and that the Liberal Democrats were, well, close enough to the Conservative Party for them to eventually get into bed with David Cameron and form a coalition government. That's not that long ago that they all seemed to be made of more or less the same stuff. Well, Jeremy Corbyn and his message definitely is not the same stuff, is it? So one of the key things of capitalism, one of the key things of the free market, is that you get choice. Choice. And above all that, Jeremy Corbyn offers a kind of a sizzle. And we know that consumers don't buy the steak, they buy the sizzle. And he's offering us some sizzle. Now, I was lying in bed this morning, dozing in and out, as you do, because I had half an hour, and so I was dozing in and out. There was a cup of tea at my elbow when I needed it. Thank you, Mrs. Boyd. And I heard Paul Ross, but I like to click around a little bit. That's not being disloyal. And I found myself having a Mr. Spreadsheet Philip Hammond-induced nap as he stonewalled repeated attempts by some radio interviewer or other, not one of ours at Talk, to try to nail him down and make him commit to either saying he would never raise taxes or he might raise taxes, or that he definitely would never raise taxes. Now, you and I know that this is a completely futile exercise. It's a waste of everybody's time. Everyone knows that politicians never commit to anything like that, especially chancellors of the Exchequer. And I'm convinced that people hate having their time wasted by hearing journalists, presenters, ask questions that will never, ever, not in a million years, be answered. You can hear in your head the researchers and producers of these programmes in their pre-programme meetings agreeing that we know the Chancellor won't answer the question, will you raise taxes, but you have to ask it anyway. It's our duty as journalists. They're wasting our time. So the interviewer, whoever it was, persisted with this, Chancellor, will you or will you not raise taxes? But here's what happened. Philip Hammond asked the interviewer to wait whilst he finished what he called was a very important point. Now, the good old very important point. We all know that Maggie it was who invented the very important point. She used to use it when the questioner had a very good question coming and kept trying to insert the question in despite the Thatcher flow. So she would say, put a hand on his knee often and go, please excuse me, Mr. Day. You must let me finish. This is a very important point. And so she went on. Was it ever a very important point? It was to her, because it stuffed the interviewer, who had to wait while she droned on with one half of her brain, while the other half mentally rehearsed how she'd deal with the interviewer's supposedly killer question, which he just revealed to her. It was her equivalent. Anybody who's old enough will remember that we had a Prime Minister called Harold Wilson, who used to pretend he was a pipe smoker. He was a cigar smoker, really, but he knew that would win him no votes with Labour supporters, so he pretended to be a pipe smoker, and whenever he was asked a difficult question, he would pretend that his pipe had gone out, and he'd get out his cigarette lighter. Yeah, Prime Ministers used to smoke whilst they were being interviewed on television, and he would, oh, excuse me a moment, and he would pretend to light his pipe, and it didn't catch straight away. And the thing was, it got him a chance to come up with a slippery answer to the good question he'd just been asked. Anyway, back to today. Hammond says he wants to finish a very important point, and this was the important point, and I quote, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, said this morning that standards of living are now twice as good as they were in 1979. I have to repeat that. He said standards of living are now twice as good as they were in 1979. I think I've got that word perfect. I tried to research it, see if I could get hold of the interview just to hear for a second time that that's what he said. I'm pretty certain he said that standards of living are now twice as good as they were in 1979. The question he'd been asked was whether capitalism was dead, and this was his argument in favour of capitalism. But the whole message of each and every entrepreneurial endeavour is this. Whenever you're asked to buy something, the deal is this. Things will get better for you if you buy this thing I'm selling. Because the essence of capitalism is hope for a better future. Hope that the future is going to be warmer and cuddlier at worst and sparkling and fantastic at best. But all if you buy this new product. Or better yet, if you can persuade people to buy the product you're flogging. The essence of the message that standards of living are twice as high as they were not long ago is something along the lines of, you've got it fantastic. So shut up and put up with everything. Hammond had been asked about the Jeremy Corbyn view that capitalism was failing, and so he said, and again, I think I've got this dead right, he said, standards of living are now twice as good as they were in 1979, which is 38 years ago. I've done the maths to save you. An odd amount of time, I agree, but of course that was the year when the Conservatives came to power and, well, to be precise, Margaret Thatcher came to power and stayed for a very long time. So between 1979 and now, which is, did I say 38 years, we've had about 25 years of Conservative rule and about 12 or 13 years of Labour rule. So whatever has gone down since 1979 is roughly 65% down to the Conservatives, the government of today. All right. And what has gone down? Let me ask you listening to this. Late at night, unless you're podcasting, in which case, good day. Late at night, I'm asking you, does it feel like that to you? Do you feel that your standard of living has doubled in the last 38 years? I mean, it's not even a rhetorical question, really, because the answer has to be no. Nobody feels like that. Whether it has or it hasn't, it doesn't feel like that. You look into the faces of people walking past you on the high street or bustling past you in the supermarket. Do they look like people who are twice as happy as they were in 1979? Definitely not. What is this thing, the standard of living? We've all heard of it. What is it? The last time I looked, it was the degree of wealth and material comfort available to a person or a community. That's the textbook definition. And there are other factors. But listen, and apply this to yourself. Ask yourself this of you. Because it depends on which bunch of researchers or survey monkeys you last heard. But generally speaking, your standard of living is this, your income. If you're old enough, is your income twice as good as it was in 1979, taking into account inflation and so on and so forth? Almost certainly not. Is the quality and availability of employment twice as good as it was in 1979? Unemployment is probably lower than it was then, but twice as good? Class disparity is another official measure of standard of living. Are we in a society that is twice as free of class distinction as it was in 1979? I don't think so. Poverty rate. The quality and availability of housing. Is that twice as good as it was in 1979? The hours of work that you have to put in to buy your absolute basic necessities. Has that halved? Gross domestic product. Inflation rate. The amount of leisure time available each year. We were told back then that these newfangled computers were going to mean that we would have an enormous amount of leisure time at our disposal because the computers would be doing the work for us. Now, there's one big lie. Do you feel as though you have twice the leisure time available to you that you or perhaps your parents or grandparents had in 1979? Affordable or free access to adequate healthcare. That is another tenet of standard of living. And I don't think anybody would argue that that is better now, twice as good now as it was in 1979. Quality of available education. Life expectancy, yes. We are living longer. Twice as long? I don't think that's a fair way of measuring it. Life expectancy has definitely increased. But in the second hour of this programme, we are going to be discussing the quality of life, of the additional life expectancy that we can all now expect. Incidence of disease, cost of services, there's only three or four more. As I tick them off, do you feel as though they're twice as good now as they were in 1979? Infrastructure of the country. National economic growth. Hello. Economic and political stability. Do we have economic and political stability more than we did in 1979? Arguably, yes, there was a lot of industrial strife in the late 1970s. But do we now have half as much as we did then? Anybody who's going to try and go to work in the south of England with the rail strikes that are threatened tomorrow and on Thursday would argue no. Political and religious freedom. That is a measure of quality of life. Do we have more political freedom now than we did in 1979? Twice as much religious freedom? There's only a couple more. Environmental quality. I don't think anybody would pretend that the environment is in any way in better shape now than it was in 1979. It's certainly not twice as good, if it's better at all. Climate, oh, and safety. Those are the 20 or so measures, which basically, we call them standards of living, but basically they come down to quality of life. Quality of life. OK. So we all have slightly fancier cars. We have mobile phones. We have smart TVs. We have fridge freezers. And we upgrade them all, don't we? According to the gospel of the consumer aspirant, chapter 1, verse 1, thou shalt have the latest model of everything, or thou shalt be humiliated by thy school friends, by thy colleagues, and by thy neighbours. I was stopped in the street by a couple of kids who were out Bible bashing on Thursday, and one of the questions they asked me was, what do I hope for most of all? Which was actually quite a good question to be asked by a 19-year-old French girl in the high street. What do I hope for most of all? And I believe I was being honest when I said, well, I think it would be nice if everybody was happy. But what does that mean? Well, peace, for example, would be one wonderful thing, God knows, wouldn't it? But peace is not just the absence of war, it's the presence of justice. And justice not just for those fallen or disabled heroes fighting in foreign fields. And justice not just for those who are fighting fires and other devastations on the home front. I'm talking about justice for those heroes who battle to make life decent for others, whether they're disabled or impoverished or inarticulate in any way. The lone partner who cares for his declining partner. The parents who every day manage to find yet more love and support for an offspring who looks at this world in which the second most important person in the country quietly tells us on the radio that standards of living have doubled. And that child feels even more wretched and hopeless because that child doesn't feel that the world is like that, and terrified that child will be of the future. So make no mistake, we have twice as many rechargeable and disposable gizmos than 20 or 30 years ago, but we also have more than double the number of Brits who are living in some form of despair. The numbers probably treble, quadruple, infinity even. Despair is everywhere, isn't it? Even though they don't seem to be able to recognise despair in Manchester, commentators are all saying that it is rife at the current party conference, which, despite every attempt to tell anyone who listened that they won the last general election, it is, by all accounts, and I do mean by all accounts, by commentators of every newspaper, radio and television station that I've seen, this party conference that's happening up in Manchester is a wake. It's a funeral. Despair. Partly because they look over the neighbour's fence and they can see JC, Jeremy Corbyn. And he's lying in the garden. No, he's lying in the allotment. And he's sunbathing. He's got his shades on and he's factor 10. Theresa May's people told her to keep away from the general public during the last election and let Jeremy Corbyn just kind of dehydrate in the spotlight. But instead, he flourished. He grew on the vine. Why? Because the little product that this entrepreneurial politician Jeremy Corbyn was selling was bright and shiny. It was hope. Now, you may say that it's false hope or wrong hope, but it's making some people feel good, and we'd all like to feel as good as the old Jeremy Corbyn singers, wouldn't we? Whatever we're singing. Jeremy offers a lot of hope. I'll tell you why. Because if a man like Jeremy Corbyn can get as close as he's getting to number 10, it means that there's hope for all of us. All of us. Because capitalism is fantastic if you're starting along the road with a bit of money and some connections and a good schooling and a family that have got some friends. You know, the kind of assets that you get if you're born well. And we want to embrace capitalism because it offers us a chance of making a success of our lives, not just scraping through. A success. And Jeremy's up there, isn't he, saying to his people, look, what I'm achieving. You can do this. You can have a bit of this. The mighty Corbyn. Political conferences can be great fun if you view them through the right prism. I'm enjoying waiting for A Star Is Born. That's one thing that will happen at the conference, because it always happens. I'm waiting for the standing ovation where they struggle to their feet and give whoever's speaking that long standing ovation and they wave and wave. I'm looking forward to the keynote speech. There's always a keynote speech. And I'm really looking forward to the embarrassing fringe meeting. There's always an embarrassing fringe meeting where some politician, some MP, has too much warm Prosecco and says something that they probably shouldn't. Let me remind you that the telephone numbers is 0344 499 1000. I'll repeat that again in just a second if you care to communicate. Or you can text 87222. Start your message with the word talk. That's 87222. Or you can tweet at Talk Radio. Quick reminder that our Facebook location is www.facebook.com/talkradiouk. And that number again, 0344 499 1000. I'm Tommy Boyd and this is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
From 11, we're going to be talking about the effect that dealing with dementia, Alzheimer's comprises some 70% of dementias, the pressures and the difficulties and the challenges that having somebody in your own home who is dealing with dementia delivers to everybody underneath that roof, but the individuals who find themselves the carers in particular. That's from 11 o'clock. In this first hour, we will bring you further news from America and the awful, unthinkable shootings that took place there less than 24 hours ago. Any further developments on that, we will bring you. But as far as discussing and debating it goes, it seems to me that it's such a clear-cut case that there really aren't any shades of opinion to be had on this one. So we're going to be sticking with the facts. And more facts, as they come in, we will report to you as quick as anybody else. But we're talking about one of the big domestic stories of the day, which, of course, is it's conference season. And there's tons going on there. So let's get a Daily Mirror-style take on that by talking to Mikey Smith. Hey, Mikey.
Hi, how you doing?
So what's going off in Manchester? Your Daily Mirror, so it's a right load of all rubbish, isn't it?
It's not great. It's not a pretty sight here in Manchester. The halls for the speeches have been barely half full for most of the day. The big speech today was Philip Hammond, who really didn't have very much to say that was that would be of comfort to anyone who's struggling. He had a couple of little announcements, but spent most of his time really refighting the battles of the 1970s, because everyone's really just struggling to come to terms with Labour and Jeremy Corbyn's resurgence.
Yeah, as I was saying when I opened the programme, all the commentators of all hues seem to be agreeing that the delegates, the grassrooters, seem to be in some sort of state of shock to discover that they won a general election and yet have no sense of victory whatsoever.
No, you're quite right. There's no sense of celebration here whatsoever. Tory conference isn't generally the most festive of affairs, but particularly this time it is a little bit like a graveyard.
You say that. I'm trying to picture Conservatives not staying up till very late at night, partying and drinking champagne, warm or otherwise. It's in their genes, isn't it?
Well, obviously, it's what, half past ten now, and people are retiring to restaurants and bars to drink Prosecco until the wee small hours. But if you go into the conference hall during the day, the atmosphere is very, very different. The speeches, there are no big announcements. There's no, considering they've just won an election, there's no sense of we just won an election. Mm. It almost feels like it's not even like they're the losing side either, because you have the Lib Dems. I was at the Lib Dem conference 2 weeks ago, and every time there's a Lib Dem conference after an election, they've just got a drubbing, and they have this sort of Dunkirk spirit, we will fight back thing. And the Tories don't have that either.
Mm. Well, we can all sympathise to a certain extent, Mikey, because I don't think anybody, possibly not even Jeremy Corbyn himself, can explain this incredible momentum that he seems to have acquired. Can you?
Well, I think you were right in your intro. I think it's a combination of two things. I think it's that he did get a lot of people to vote that don't normally vote, and a lot of those people are very young people. And it's that he had a message of hope. I mean, whether it's deliverable or not is another question. But he had a message of hope for people, whereas the Tories just didn't. They had, you know, either more of the same or it's going to get worse. Hmm. And that's what's missing here. There's no message coming out of Tory conference that people have anything to really look forward to.
Yeah, you see, I'm astonished, and I think a lot of people are astonished by that, because the last time a Labour leader proposed the kind of things that Jeremy Corbyn appears to be proposing, it was probably someone called Michael Foot, and they took him to the cleaners and loved every minute of it.
They did. But what Jeremy Corbyn, if you listen to his speech last week, the big part of Jeremy Corbyn's speech was, you know, the political consensus has moved left in the last couple of years. And I think he's right. I think the things it is acceptable to say to people and say, please vote for us, we're going to do this, I think they've changed. I mean, if you look at the polling that was done after the Labour manifesto leaked just before the election, all of the promises in it were majority positive responses from the people who were polled. So it's an unusual thing. I don't think you can underestimate how much the youth vote made a difference. Mm. Because I went to Labour conference too. This is my third conference in a row, and I'm pretty tired. Mm. But the influx of young people at a Labour conference was incredible. Mm. It was noticeable. There was a huge number of young people. There was a lot of energy there at different events and things like that. But it just seemed like a really youthful energy about it for the first time in years.
Okay,
and
so
If you look at the average age of the Tory party membership, it's 71 years old.
No, is that a fact?
It is a fact. The average age of Tory party membership, not voters,
no,
but membership,
yeah,
71 years old.
Ah, that is an interesting stat. We got the same for Labour?
I don't.
No.
I don't have that number for Labour. But it
12.
I mean, if you look at Tory conference today, the advice I've been given today is if there's anyone between the ages of, there's quite a few sort of young Tories who are quite enthusiastic, but if you see anyone between the ages of 25 and sort of 45, yeah, they're probably a lobbyist,
right,
and not actually a member of the party.
Okay, great. One last thing, Mikey, I'm going to get you to be really bare your heart on this one. They're all sitting around at the moment at the various restaurant tables in Manchester, and they're all talking about the thing that's really on their mind, which is, of course, the leadership issue.
Yeah.
And everybody's got their own scenario. I'm not going to bore you with mine as to how it's all going to pan out over the weeks and months. But what's yours? What's going to happen?
Well, the real talk of this conference, you were saying, you know, you were waiting for the keynote speech, the big moment where everyone rises to their feet. I don't think that's going to happen in the conference all this year.
Ooh.
Where that's happening is in the fringe events where Ruth Davidson, the Scottish Tory leader, is speaking. She is getting an incredibly good reception this year. She is sort of centrist. She is very polished. She's almost Blair-esque.
Yeah.
In her polish. And she's funny. She's got a really great sense of humour. And she engages with people really well.
Yeah.
And I can totally see her. If she can work out the logistics of getting into Westminster at some point before the next election,
yeah,
either through a by-election or some other means, or, you know, people have been saying she might join the House of Lords. I don't think that's likely. but, you know...
Now, I remember a moment from... I'm sad enough to have been watching a bit of the Scottish Assembly some months ago, and there was a great moment when she was speaking and Nicola Sturgeon got up to try and interrupt her, and she just went, sit down and shut up! And she did. And I did as well. And I was on my way to the kitchen with an empty teacup, and I sat down and shut up.
But, I mean, it's pointless trying to get into a shouting match with Nicola Sturgeon, because you're not going to win that.
No.
But
no.
If she ended up in Westminster, I mean, I don't know. I've just come from an event where Ruth Davidson was speaking, and they did a show of hands in the room of, you know, who would like Ruth Davidson to be the party leader, and it was by far the majority in the room.
Right.
I think she's got the momentum, and I can see her being Prime Minister one day.
Okay, that's a really clean cut. Call. Well done, Mikey, nailing your colours to the mast. Thanks for your time.
No problem. Thanks.
Get some sleep.
I will try.
Cheers. He's a liar, isn't he, Kat? He's going to the bar.
I should think so, too. He's had a very long few
weeks.
Quite
right, too. Yeah.
On the books. I told you he was good, though, didn't I?
He's great. Are you entitled as a producer and journalist to offer your prognosis on what's going to happen as far as the leadership of the government? As it is at the moment,
I haven't got the first
party.
Clue. It just
you
seems
liar.
Like a shambles.
You're playing your cards close to
no,
your
I just don't know enough about it, to be honest. It seems like an absolute mess, and I wish someone would just tell us what exactly is going on, even if they haven't got a clue. And we all have the suspicion that they haven't got a clue.
What are the leadership qualities that you look for in a leader, you?
I would like someone to be authentic, and by that I mean, tell me if you don't know something, but tell me how you're going to find it out for me. Tell me if you can't do something. Tell me what you're going to do about it.
But that goes against the grain of all the tuition that they've had.
Yeah.
All of our politicians as they made their way through the school debating society and had to listen when their parents and uncles and aunts sat around the dining table on a Sunday roast and talked politics, and they learned that actually, you know, you play your cards close to your chest.
I know, but everyone's seen through the political speak. You know, as someone who... I started university the year that Tony Blair came into power, and it seemed like he was the refreshing change, you know. But actually what happened was we realised that politics got a whole lot swisher, and the way they fed us stuff got a lot sleeker. But... and more controlled. And, you know, I started journalism in a time when, you know, central office was very, very powerful, and the way they disseminated news was very controlled. And actually, I think the majority of people have got wise to it now. And what we want is just tell it to us straight, you know, because we can see beyond the BS. And there's nothing that's going to turn someone off like being fibbed to.
Is that because the electorate are just that much more sophisticated, or are our politicians not so good at doing it as they used to? Because Tony Blair was a fantastic act.
Yeah, until he wasn't.
Well, when he retired on his last day, before he took the Chiltern Hundreds or whatever it is that enables you to get out of politics like that and not have to declare your earnings, not have to declare your other interests or your free holidays, he got out of the House of Commons like that.
Yeah.
1 minute he was Prime Minister, and the next minute he needed a pass to get in. And he got the only ever standing ovation from all sides of the House of Commons that's ever been afforded a politician.
Yeah. He's a standout figure, isn't he?
Yeah, he was that well regarded by absolutely everybody. And there are people who say that Cameron even indeed based his act on Tony Blair.
Yeah.
And he's funny too. Tony Booth sadly passed away a couple of 3 days ago, the actor, who, of course, is the father of Tony Blair's wife, Cherie Blair. And I was tickled in one of the obituaries to read that he was always winding Tony Blair up, Tony Booth. And one day they were arguing over Sunday roast again. And he said to Tony Blair, what do you think of euthanasia then? And Blair replied, for you, yes. But not for anybody else. OK, you can join the conversation, of course. The telephone number is 0344 499 1000. We are talking about, well, the state of play, really, in the country, but particularly with the political conferences going on and the government, the Conservative Party, holding their conference at the moment, and the Prime Minister being about to deliver the inevitable keynote speech. We've heard rumours that she's going to say, I am very sorry, it was all my fault. I wish I hadn't called that general election. I apologise to all the Conservative MPs who are no longer Conservative MPs and to those Conservative MPs who used to have a thumping majority and are now frightened for their lives because there might be a general... Well, she won't say there might be a general election soon, but that's in all probability a truth. And she will say, what do they call it, mea culpa?
Yes. Do you think she'll say that?
Well, I'm always grateful for people who allow us into their lives and to see their highs and lows. Because I don't watch EastEnders, because I prefer real people. And that's why I've always really been very grateful to sportsmen and women, because they show us, they allow us to see their utter defeats and their utter victories. And politicians are a bit like that. I read recently that Theresa May cried real tears on the night when the general election results were coming in, and she realised that she, you know, really had made a mess of it, and she was going to have to deal with it somehow. And it's things like that that make me like her more than I did.
The writing was on the wall over her long before that, wasn't it? When everyone, you know, of course, the least hotly contested leadership election there was for the Conservative Party, you know, all of a sudden all the likely lads stepped down and said, you can have it, because I think they saw it coming. And
could be.
She's carrying the can, I feel.
Could be. The poison chalice theory.
Yeah, yeah.
0344 499 1000 is the number. You can text 87222, 87222. Start your message with the word talk. Or you can tweet us at Talk Radio. It's a good idea to read out our Facebook contacts, Kath. I'm happy to do it. It's just that
we don't tend
I wouldn't
to look
be
at
able
that
to
stuff.
Take it down if I was at home. That's basis I always use.
Give us a ring. Voice is always better, I think.
Okay. 0344 499 1000. This is Tommy Boyd in for the wonderful Ian Lee, and Kath Boyle is here.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
In for Ian Lee, and what are we discussing? Jeremy Corbyn, is he the symbol of capitalism in as much as... No, he says it's failed, but is he not typical of capitalism at its best in that he is offering the consumer real choice and he's offering them something that is beautifully packaged, it's bright, it's shiny, it offers to change your life for the better. We all know in our heart of hearts that that new smartphone won't really do that, but in the hope that it might, we buy the darn thing. Also, we've got this suggestion from the Chancellor that our standards of living are twice as good as they were in 1979. Does it really feel like that to you? 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is Talk Radio, and over to Reading, where Julian waits to talk to us. Hello, Julian.
Hello, Tommy. I'm in shock.
Yes, I understand.
Do you?
Because?
Because I'm talking to you.
Oh.
What is this, Tommy? What are you doing?
What am I doing?
Yeah.
Can you just refine your point so that I understand exactly what you mean?
Well, I used to listen to you regularly when I was 15, 16, and then you disappeared, and now you pitch up now and then.
Yes.
What are you doing?
I can't talk about what I do on a day-to-day basis, Monday to Friday. Well, actually, 7 days a week, 24/7. It's something that's completely unconnected with radio, broadcasting in general, the media. It's got nothing to do with any of that. And I've never been more fulfilled doing that thing in my whole life. But
are you back I like to dolphin training?
No. I enjoy radio enormously, and I have an opportunity, thanks to the flexibility of the schedules here, to do a little bit here and a little bit there. And I have to say, I find it very invigorating being John Holmes one day and then Ian Lee another day and then James Whale another day, because you take on shades of the show when you're standing in for somebody. You have to. It's polite. And they're good broadcasters. So I've become a little bit James Whale. I become a little bit Ian Lee. I become a little bit John Holmes, and I enjoy doing that.
You take on their personality.
Well, I don't do something totally different from what they do, because one of the things about broadcasting in general, the media in general, is that people like to know what they're going to get. So I wouldn't
You're not a broadcaster, Tommy.
No, nobody said that to me for about 20 minutes.
Well, but you just are you. You come on and you be real. And that's what I always enjoyed about your shows.
Yes, there is that of the Corbyn in me. I'm authentic, I think. I'll tell you what, there's less Alan Partridge in me than there was when I started. Because whenever anybody starts in broadcasting, there's a lot of Alan Partridge. Isn't that right, Kath?
Absolutely. It takes a long time to just relax stuff.
Get rid of it and tell it like it is, as best you can. Anyway, Julian, you've been far too polite and flattering.
Well, I'd love to argue with you, but you haven't said anything I disagree with yet.
Oh, my God.
But I just wish you were on regularly, Tom. I know you're doing other things. I wish you were on regularly.
Well, let me flag up something we're doing tomorrow night, then, because I've managed to track down an organisation that's based in Scotland, which is the Centre for Argument Technology. I'll say that again. It is.
No,
the
it isn't.
Now, I'll be playing that sketch.
OK.
I'll dedicate
no,
it to
won't.
You, sir. No, you won't.
that's a good. Argue unless you've paid.
Yeah, do you know that is actually my favourite Monty Python sketch? I think.
Yeah, it is the best. It's superb.
Well, I quite like the one.
No. On the Human Zoo. I've never seen it on Monty Python. I just know it being played down the phone on a Sunday night from 10.
Oh, you should see it because John Cleese and Michael Palin, it is, who are the two real stars of Monty Python. I think did it absolutely superbly. But I think my all-time favourite sketch is the one where Eric Idle is the son of Graham, plays the son of Graham Chapman, who is a literary figure who is disappointed to discover that his son wants to become a coal miner, which is a complete reversal of the old, you know, the Northern Poets thing. And he says, literary circle's not good enough for you, eh? And so on and so forth. All right, Julian, call me again sometime, do you promise?
Thank you.
Good man.
Well, I hope you, I get the chance.
Well, you fight for your right. 0344 499 1000 if you want to make your point or be utterly smarmy. I don't mind. No, he wasn't smarmy. He was a good egg. To Birmingham now, from Reading to Birmingham, and it's Alan. Hello, Alan.
Evening, boss.
Evening, underling.
How are you? How are you, sir?
I'm feeling... I'm borrowing a phrase I read from Danny Baker in the Sunday supplement yesterday. He said, I'm great. I'm giving off sparks. That's what I say now.
Yeah, it's good to have you on late night, and I hope Kath's not been too much trouble for you.
No, none at all. I know what you mean, but no, she hasn't. Thank you, Alan, for your kind wishes. Let's move on to Crewe. The Cheshire Crewe, and Jerry, who's our next caller. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, Tommy. How are you?
I'm giving off sparks. How are you?
Sparks?
Yeah.
I say technology and care and make care better and worse.
Okay.
In terms of care for a lot of people, opening up opportunities for a lot of people. I've got Parkinson's, Tommy, so if I get a bit shaky, that's why.
That's all right, mate. Can I ask you a couple of questions about that, or did you want to talk about something else?
Yeah, any question you got. That's sure. 28.
Okay. What sort of medication do you have available to you just to mitigate some of the awful effects of Parkinson's?
Lopinirol. That's the main one. Brings many addictions and demons. We've got gambling addictions. Those addictions to spoons and cinemas brings shakiness. It makes you shake.
Yeah.
But I'd like to say that technology is anybody wants to live a long life is a fool. It's only going to get worse. Technology is imprisoning people. They got fools. Maybe self care is in sitting with people and you've got monitors serving new into us. Millions of old people are isolated in their own homes, in prison. Both day centres are shut down. Can't go out anywhere. Just stuck in all day. Just meals on wheels, which are disgusting, in my opinion. Okay. It's a nightmare, Tommy. It's only getting worse.
What can you do for yourself? Can you cook for yourself, for example, at all?
No, pardon?
Can you cook for yourself at all?
No, my lad, we're in a care room. My lad's cook. No, that's a touch up, sharp imprint. He was a responsible adult.
Can you dress and undress yourself?
I can't imagine to bring my wrist into voice dog Saturday, Tommy. Bring my wrist all down. Bring my wrist. So,
are you able to use a keyboard?
Yes, I'm able to use a keyboard quite well.
Okay.
Right, so my brain's all there. The body's very useless, but the brain's all there. I write quite well.
It's a an utterly, utterly miserable condition, and I just want to say, I'm flattered and honoured that you call and want to talk, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Okay, Tommy, take care.
And you, Jerry.
Bye.
Bye. I was on a train, Kath, coming up from the West Country, and so it's a long train journey into Paddington. And so I went to the bar. What else are you going to do? And sitting in the connecting part of the carriage with the buffet in it and the next lot of the next carriage, which had seats in it, you know that bit that jiggles?
Yeah.
Sat there was a man, and I sat down and started talking to him because he clearly had Parkinson's, and he said that my biggest difficulty he had was that there was medication that would reduce the activity of his arms and the uncontrolled activity of his body,
yeah,
which was one of the symptoms. But it slowed him down.
Mm.
And he said, I'm going to enjoy having a chat with you. If you forgive me occasionally thumping you in the mouth or knocking your beer over, if I were to take my medication and therefore look like everybody else, more or less,
yeah,
I wouldn't be good for any kind of a conversation. It would just like talking to a piece of furniture, and I have to go from one to the other all the time.
Yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible. And Jerry rings us up, and you know, and sometimes he's easier to understand on the phone than other times. You know, and warm nights really are not his friend. You know,
is that right?
Yeah, they make the tremors worse. So,
is that right? What is that?
I have no idea. Temperature. Ian's told us that his mum has MS, and she has similar problems. She has less control over her limbs. You know, when it's warm. It's a very odd thing. You know, and the cruelest thing is that there's absolutely nothing wrong at all with Jerry's brain.
No.
And he's a young man. He's in his 40s.
No.
He's a good lad. He's very funny.
Good for him. In the next hour of the programme, we're going to be talking about dementia, but in particular, the challenges that people face when untrained, with no specialist background, no specialist knowledge, they find themselves caring for somebody with dementia. But I suppose we could broaden it as well, and talk about everybody who is caring for people who have physical or mental conditions that are challenging to that individual, but therefore challenging as well to the family member or partner or whatever who is looking after them. Reminder of our phone number, it's 0344 499 1000. Jonathan is in Swansea. Hey, Jonathan.
Hello, Tommy.
Hey.
Hi. Jeremy Corbyn is a symbol of capitalism. Jeremy Corbyn is as much a symbol of capitalism as an Alistair Campbell dossier is a symbol of truth and integrity.
Why, you've had plenty of time to write that one down, haven't you?
Oh, no, this is all off the top of my head.
You liar.
No, believe you me.
Your conversation is as well sculpted as that.
Oh, yes. The key to being a great leader, I discovered that for myself 9 years ago, and I was pleasantly surprised when a certain Donald Trump implemented my strategy.
What do you mean a certain Donald Trump? You talk like that man in Fawlty Towers, played by Bernard Cribbins.
I like Bernard Cribbins.
But I'm not talking about Bernard Cribbins, I'm talking about the character who spoke in a particularly unlikely way for a human being to articulate their intentions.
Oh,
so a certain Donald Trump. Now, look, let's get back to what I'm saying. If you were listening, as opposed to trying to work out an interesting opening sentence, if you'd been listening to what I'd said, Jeremy Corbyn, in a sense, represents all that's good about capitalism because he has given the consumer choice where before we didn't really have any, and he is offering consumers a bright and shiny and glistening product which may or may not work, which is exactly what they do with the new mobile phones and the new electric cars and all the rest of it, which is consumerism at its greatest, and that is what Corbyn is doing. Now, Jonathan, I know it doesn't seem likely to you, but you have to admit, it's a brilliant, brilliant point.
No, because offering a mirage up as water.
No, I've done that. Done that. I've explained that. Explained that. That's what capitalists do. They offer up mirage. They offer up hope in the next smartphone, mate. Come on, keep up, keep up. Come on,
well, I think,
Jonathan.
I think if that's the case, then they've lost the market to socialism when it comes to creating mirages that people believe in.
Nobody, if they live to be 110, will understand what you just said.
Choice and a mirage are two different things. Corbyn is not offering choice. He is offering a mirage.
No, look, Petal, let me just explain to you once again. If I have to explain this again, Jonathan, I'll get a little bit uptight, all right? The choice that we had between the three political parties up to and including about 7 to 10 years ago was the same kind of choice that the residents of East Germany had when they contacted the East German Gas Board and asked for their choice of a new oven. And they were told that they would have the East German oven or the East German oven. And that's how it was in politics until Jeremy Corbyn came along and gave the electorate a genuine choice. Whether you like it or not, it's a genuine choice between everything that is capitalism and everything that isn't. And I'm going to ask you now to tell me when was the last time the British electorate had such a wide range of choice. Give me the year.
We've never had a wide range of choices.
That's why Jeremy Corbyn represents capitalism, which is all about choice.
No, he doesn't. All of the parties, even now, are different shades of socialism. There's no real choice. If there was a choice, we would have people like Ron Paul running for office and winning elections.
No, you're drifting again now.
Socialist light and socialist full fat.
You're drifting. I'm making a most beautiful point, and with such absolute clarity and elegance, frankly. There's a huge elegance of this idea that some geezer on the radio can turn the full circle of all this nonsense around to the idea that there is an element of the entrepreneurial spirit in Jeremy Corbyn that suggests that there's more of the capitalist in him than there is in Theresa May. And whoever is running the Lib Dems at the moment, I forget.
Vince Cable.
It? Vince Cable. Thanks very much indeed. This is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB. The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment. For those about to talk, we salute you.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
I'm not so much, I don't know if this applies to you, dear listener, I'm not so much afraid of dying as I am of the fact that I don't know at this moment in time what I'm going to die of. I think it is that uncertainty. I know I'm going to die. In fact, we don't spend enough of our time remembering that we're not here forever. Nobody gets out of this one alive. I think it's possible that we would lead much more enriching lives if we remembered that we are not here forever and that whatever tomorrow brings, it should be as good as possible because it's the only tomorrow we're ever going to get. I mean, what's today? The 1st of October? Tomorrow is the only 2nd of October 2017 I, you, everybody will ever experience. So let's make the most of that one day. We're all going to die. It's a gift. Nobody wants to die. I don't know anybody who wants to die. Obviously, some people reach such depths of despair, and I, thankfully, cannot imagine what that is like to begin to contemplate taking your own life. But that isn't something that makes pain go away. It's something that simply transfers that pain to other people, those who are left behind the person who has taken their own life. But wondering how we're going to die, that is an enormous burden. And it was generally the case until something like 10 or 15 years ago that we would either die suddenly or we would die of a protracted physical ailment. Those were the two main things that would take us away. And I remember being advised by an elderly lady once that she had a number of sympathy cards in her bureau and she knew that on each of them she was going to write, "At least we can be thankful that Frank's end was swift." Or, "At least we can be thankful that Emily had an opportunity to tell everyone how much she loved them and how much she was loved." Those were the two ways. Now there's a third way. There are actually more than three ways, because it seems to me that one of the biggest problems we're going to be facing as a country, as a society, in the not-too-distant future, is going to be the state of mental health of our young people. But we are slowly waking up to that. Whether we can do something about it or not, only time will tell. But the big thing that has crept up on us and has now exploded is, of course, dementia. And the increasing number of people. It was tens of thousands, now it's hundreds of thousands, it won't be long before it is millions of people who are living with, helping, caring for people who are, and I'm going to use the word suffering from, because it is a suffering, suffering from dementia in one form or another. So little is known about it. So little is known about the causes of it. So little is known about how we might be able to stop or reverse even the decline, because so little is known about exactly what happens, exactly what goes on in the brain that induces this, initially, it seems, an inability to remember small things. And blimey, we all search, don't we, for somebody's name from time to time. That's absolutely normal. I can remember my first ever para-dementia activity took place when I was 7. I was watching television and somebody gave me a sweet and it had a wrapper. And I unwrapped the sweet, threw the sweet in the fire and ate the wrapper, or at least put it in my mouth. And I remember thinking, what's wrong with me? Well, there was nothing wrong with me. I just wasn't concentrating on what I was doing. But an increasing number of people experience such moments of forgetfulness, which they think might be lack of concentration, but then it happens again and again and again. Dementia is now an enormous problem for the country, an even bigger problem for those who are having to deal with it. And there are two sets of people who are having to deal with it, all day and every day. The professionals, of course, are confronted with it in a professional environment, whether that's a doctor's surgery or a hospital. But there are people who are confronted with it 24/7. And those are the people who are experiencing dementia and the people who are caring for the people who are experiencing dementia. If this is something that you have any personal experience of, I'd welcome your contribution. Between now and 12 o'clock, we will, of course, keep you informed if there are any important developments in the story of the tragic, terrible shooting near Las Vegas in the United States, of course. But at the moment, between now and 12 midnight, we're talking about what it's like to be with somebody in the house all day, every day, or every evening, or whatever, who is dealing with a dementia. The number is 0344 499 1000. I'll repeat that again in just a second. Or you can text, if you think you can cram it into a text, 87222 87222. Start your message with the word talk. That number again is 0344 499 1000. We're joined in the studio by Mark. It was Mark who is a regular Talk Radio listener. Hi, Mark.
Good evening.
Who contacted me and just alerted me to how important it might be if we can just start to share the experiences of people who are looking after people with dementias. And it happened like this. Mark didn't contact me and say, "Help, I've got something that I'm dealing with at home." What Mark did was he contacted me and said, did I know that another talk radio listener was having to deal with a particular set of difficulties in this area, and that person might appreciate an email from me, which has happened and which we'll come to a little bit later on in this hour. But Mark, the fact is that you had been swapping experiences with that other talk radio listener because it's something that affects you as well. So I want to hand over to you and telling us what you can, bearing in mind that you can be anonymous or respect the anonymity of the person that you are happy to talk about, if that's appropriate or not, and tell us your story.
My mother has early Alzheimer's. She developed symptoms when she was about 59. She's now 66. And it's been a long, slow, painful decline. There's no two ways about it. It's very messy, and one has to navigate that as best they can. I'm an only child, so I think there's an extra burden. In fact, we were talking before the show whether it would be indeed easier with siblings or without, because I do direct the show so much as look after her finances, the care plan, the rota, deal with, you know, all the machinations of daily life when she can't, unfortunately, do it herself. We're very close, which makes it especially painful. She can't really do much for herself, to be honest with you. So we have assistance throughout the day to help with the ablutions and hygiene and so on. And we have assistants or carers, if you will. I prefer to call them assistants. Take her out when I'm working, or I can't be there, and her partner is in the house. But you know, we were discussing this before the show. It's awful. It's horrible. It's a very slow, painful decline. So there's no one pivotal moment at which you suddenly realise that this is what it is. It's very gradual, but you have to make the most of it. And there's still a lot she can do. And I think it's so important, and we can maybe get onto this later, to kind of look for those moments of levity, to appreciate the moments of lightness and humour, and even if it's inappropriate humour. So we try to make the very best of it, and every situation is unique.
Who noticed it first?
I had my suspicions. She was made redundant from a fairly kind of very good job where she had a lot of responsibility at a big company in the city, and within about 2 weeks after she was made redundant, and I incidentally, she said she came off HRT at that time, and there was a marked change in her behaviour. She became agitated, and I noted a kind of sense of agitation every time we spoke. So I've always lived very close to her. Fortunately, that helps with the situation now. But I never used to visit her every day, but we'd speak every day, and I noticed something that wasn't quite right. And it turned out, or transpired, that she'd kept it from us. She was alerted and worried by her own forgetfulness.
So she spotted it first.
She spotted it first, and
did she do anything about it? She didn't tell you, but did you know she went to see her doctor? And should she have done that?
Yeah, she should have, and she did. And she went to see her GP, and it was a locum standing in at the time. And unfortunately, that GP at the time, a fairly newly qualified doctor, said, "You're too young to have Alzheimer's." My mother didn't tell me that until she'd actually been diagnosed. And obviously, if I'd have known that at the time, it would have been a different story.
What could have been done, do you suppose, if that diagnosis had been made when she went to the GP in the first place, you know, as early as possible? Is there anything that can be done? Now, you read about mental exercises. The newspapers now are full of, well, certain newspapers are full of things about, you know, do this to stave off dementia, do these mental exercises to stave off dementia. Knowing what you know, would you have any faith in those sorts of preventatives?
Absolutely. I mean, if she had it, there's obviously no real chance that she's going to find any kind of cure. It would be a question of prolonging it. So I was told by the professors at the Royal London Hospital that the medication would have a better chance of working, far better, the earlier it's prescribed.
Is there medication now?
Yeah, she always will be. Yeah.
What is that?
She's on two medications, one called Donepezil, another one called Memantine. And what I have learned, and a little bit of advice, and I'm happy to give any advice I can from my own experiences, there's many, many others out there who probably know much more than I do, but one thing I would say is you've got to push for these things. I mean, it's even dosages and even working with the doctors. Sometimes you have to be very proactive. You can't just assume and expect that you'll get everything you want without asking or prompting or putting a case forward. Unfortunately, we've got a very good old age psychiatrist who my mother has as a dementia consultant, if you will. And we work very closely with him.
How does that work? Does she visit him or he visits you?
We visit him every 3 months, and it's really useful.
And what goes down at that meeting?
It's just a really informal, casual chat, unless there is a particular issue at the time. So if my mum is developed and she hasn't, you know, touch wood so far, manifested a severe and sudden decline, which incidentally probably wouldn't be the dementia, because that's a consistent gradual decline in most cases of Alzheimer's, at least early Alzheimer's. But if something was awry, then we would address it. Otherwise, it's generally just a nice chat. Mm. They undertake a little mini mental exam of my mum. That's painful to watch as she gets less answers correct every time.
Just hold that there for a second. I do want to come back to that. I just want to say where we are in the show. Good evening if you just joined us. It's Talk Radio. It's Tommy Boyd in for Ian Lee. Between 11 and 12, we're talking because we have Talk listeners who've contacted me about their circumstances in looking after people who are carrying dementias. So we have Mark here, and we have by email another Talk listener who is looking after their partner, and we'll get to that one a little bit later on. But we are talking about not the medical side of things. We're not talking to experts in this hour. We're talking to people who have real experience of dealing 24/7 with a person under their roof who is necessarily not going to get any better. We can say that with some certainty, can't we? Nobody's been cured of dementia, as far as we know.
You're right, yeah.
Okay. And if your experiences are such like, 0344 499 1000 is the number. 0344 499 1000. Mark was just explaining to us that he takes his mum to see an old age psychiatrist, I think you said, and some sort of test questions are asked, and you, sitting there with your mum, you can hear that the questions, that the, her successful answers diminish as time goes by. What sort of questions?
Remembering three words, and then those words are repeated a few minutes later. In between other questions, what time of the year it is, where are we, what floor are we on, and such like. And when she had her first test, I mean, she got the vast majority of the questions right. Uh-huh. Every year, every 3 months rather, there's less so. And it's important to note that that isn't necessarily the only thing to concern oneself with when it comes to visiting a consultant. I mean, the test can vary if she's had a good day, and there are good days and bad days with Alzheimer's especially.
Is that connected to anything that you can pinpoint?
It's for my mother, at least, it's very much about a routine. So if she's thrown out of her routine, that might compromise the way the day's set up. If she's left to lay in bed, if her partner doesn't get her up in time, she doesn't have her morning shower, the whole day it does seem to be compromised. The other thing I'd say is any ailment, so if she's got constipation or hemorrhoids, it's magnified 10 times. That often is one of the trickiest things with dementia. It's not so much the Alzheimer's itself, it's the things that go around with it. When she can't necessarily communicate and articulate exactly what's bothering her. So, for instance, earlier today she was feeling queasy. She wasn't herself. I've noticed it the last few days. It's a game of give us a clue. In many ways, while she's compos mentis and she can talk about past experiences or share a conversation about what's on the telly, just trying to prise out of her what is actually happening in her body physiologically, is a test, and that requires a fair bit of patience. That's part of the whole equation as well.
Talking about dementia, and in particular, what it is to be looking after somebody who is carrying dementia. The phone number again is 0344 499 1000. That's 0344 499 1000. If you can get it into a text, the details are 87222. Start your message with the word talk. That's 87222. Start your message with the word talk. I'm Tommy Boyd, in for Ian Lee. You're listening to Talk Radio.
The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
0344 499 1000 is the number. We're talking about dementia from the perspective of people who find themselves caring for or assisting, supporting people who are carrying dementia. Laura's called the show from Camden. Hello, Laura.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I heard you say a few moments ago, well, I thought I heard you say that there hadn't been any cases of reversal in dementia, and I have to disagree with you. If you look up Dale Bredesen, he's a professor and a doctor. He's put several years of research into this, and he has succeeded in turning around most cases.
Most cases?
Yeah, most cases that he's dealt with. He's, and about 1 month ago, he...
What's his treatment?
Well, it's a multi-pronged approach, and he released a book on it about 1 month ago. He's done conferences around the world.
How come you know so much as you do about this?
Well, I went to a couple of conferences. Both of them were about his protocol. You can find lot about him.
I'm interested in why. Do you have experience of this, or are you a professional?
No, I'm not a professional. No, I'm just very interested in different health approaches for different things, and I believe that any chronic illness, all chronic illnesses are ultimately, you know, have some common... denominators. So anyway, and
so how would you describe his treatment? Is it an alternative treatment of some form?
Well, what is alternative? It's multi-pronged, so you have to look at different causes, different reasons. Each person has different.
Tell me the guy's name, and I'll look him up.
His first name is Dale. His last name is Bredesen, Bredesen. He's a professor and he's a doctor. And he's also married to a doctor. And he's been researching this for several years. And he's got a book out on it, which I think was launched about a month ago by, I think, Penguin. And it's called The Bredesen Protocol.
Yeah, you so see, my mum... succumbed to dementia.
Yeah.
And it was what it is for everybody who is diagnosed with dementia. There is no cure, and I'll absolutely stand by that, Laura, and I'm afraid 99.9% of professionals and people who are dealing with looking after people who have dementia will agree with that, tragically. That's how it is at the moment. It would be nice if it weren't. It would be wonderful if it weren't the case. But it does appear to be the case. And it's such a staggering and towering issue facing society at the moment that if anybody were to come up with something which was, I don't think you used the word cure, but I think you may have used the word reverse the effects of
reversal.
Dementia, then, well, quite frankly, I'd know about it. Mark would know about it.
Well, there's a first time for everything, and you sound really quite agitated. There's a first time for hearing about anything. I am always...
Yes, but you don't usually hear about it from somebody calling a phone-in programme.
To hear about it?
Well, you're not meant to hear about anything, but the usual process of the dissemination of information like this comes through organisations such as the British Medical Journal, for example. For one example... You would hope that doctors, GPs and hospital doctors would be aware that there is some kind of a process.
Dr. Bredesen has had many medical publications, if you'd care to look them up. But there is a first time for hearing about anything, so instead of
reacting with a closed mind... Hang on.
Because that's how you're coming across. You come across.
No, I'm not coming across as that any more than you're coming across
as that. Well, on the phone, you do sound agitated about it and quite defensive about it.
Yes, because you have presented it aggressively.
I didn't present it aggressively.
Yes,
I was,
you did.
I was suggesting that you might want to look him up.
And I'm doing it, and I can't see anything that gives me hope, which I want. I'm doing it now.
Gosh.
I'm looking at it now. Well, I'm trying to work out what it is that we can pass on to our listeners, pass on to the nation, pass on to the whole freaking world.
It's a multi-pronged approach. So
you've said that three times.
Yes, so basically...
But what is absolute? What is new?
Different individuals have different causes for it.
Yes, we know all that. But what I need you
listen, wait.
I need you to just tell me what it is that's new that he does that nobody else is doing, and people like Mark looking after his mum, and Robert, who we're going to get.
Very angry. You do. You sound very angry.
Because I'm concerned that you're offering false hope.
I'm not giving any... Listen...
Just tell me what it is that he does that nobody else
doctor,
is doing.
And you can look up the protocol, you can look up the book. It's not a quick...
I'll ask you one more time, Laura.
It's not
please,
one size fits
Laura, please,
all.
Please. I'll ask you one more time because I really am interested. We all are. We all are. If you can just tell us, simply... what it is in a nutshell that he does differently that nobody else knows about.
You can't look, it's a multi-pronged approach, so he deals with...
Okay,
so
we'll all look it up. Thanks, Laura. We'll all look it up. I hope you're right, Laura. I hope you're right.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
You do, Mark. You hope she's right.
Absolutely.
I reckon that almost everybody listening at the moment knows somebody that they would like to help. I'm not going to pass on some kind of false hope without testing it hard. I hope Laura's right. I really, really do. But I'm afraid she couldn't help me by simply saying he does this differently. He offers this medication which nobody else has got.
Yeah.
He offers these mental exercises or physical exercises. That's what I was looking for. That's what I wanted to know. And whilst I'm going to let you carry on with your story, Mark, because I am going to investigate this guy, because I've got him up on screen.
Well, I mean,
now.
I just had a quick look there. I absolutely would love to know if there's any kind of reversal treatment or anything like that at all. I mean, I have come across it before, vaguely. It does seem that it's experimental, based on pretty thin gruel, as some medical journal has quoted. And there's a fair bit of criticism. However, you know, I personally appreciate all new information, and it's reminded me to go and look up this chap and dig in further and deeper. There are other things that I looked at on this meandering journey of caring and for a mother with Alzheimer's, and one is coconut oil. Actually, the MCTs in coconut oil. MCT means multi-chain triglycerides. Please don't quiz me on the exact nature of how it interacts with the brain and so on, but there's a number of YouTube videos by a professor in the States. I think she has a she's a professor of some medical field. It's not related to Alzheimer's. Her husband developed it, and from memory here, she looked at the various kind of elements of coconut and what it could do for the brain. And I'm speaking very basically here, because if you spend a few minutes having a look on YouTube and Google, you'll see that there's actually some testing to say that could help. So I went and pursued it with my mother. She unfortunately hates the taste of coconut, but within 2 weeks I did see a difference.
Okay.
So
the thing is that we have to be on our guard against, and this applies really to any physical or emotional illness, we have to be on our guard against false hope, and we have to hope, but we have to be on our guard against practitioners who offer expensive treatments which are unproven. Now, Laura called with the best possible will in the world, but I have not heard from any professional... I personally have not heard from any professional in the media or anywhere who has said that dementias can be reversed or, to use a colloquialism, cured. Now, Mark, that's your experience too. You've been dealing with this as a carer of your mum for the last 6 years. You would love to hope that coconut oil did the trick. You would love to discover that smoking marijuana, whatever...
Yeah.
It was that somebody came up and said, this will help a little bit, but you're not expecting to discover a cure.
No, absolutely not. I'd be delighted if there was one. And I think I think it's the little things you can do. So I mentioned coconut and diet, avocado, exercise. You know, all these things will help.
You can alleviate.
They will absolutely. But
you can slow the process?
Potentially.
Do you believe that you can slow the process?
Yes.
Do you believe that you can stagnate the process? So that a person remains where they are from the point that they receive that treatment or medication? Your gut.
Well, I would say all Alzheimer's disease is a different. I mean, every single one is like a snowflake. There's a catch-all term, obviously dementia, and within that all the various neurodegenerative diseases, of which early Alzheimer's is very common. They're all very different. Mm. Some may stagnate, others may not. I would hope my mother's does. I doubt it, personally.
OK, well, listen, I'm grateful to Laura for her call. Any assertion that a cure has been found for Alzheimer's, I don't think she actually said that, but it sounded a bit as though she was going in that direction, has to be treated with absolute caution and explored very carefully before we broadcast it. But thank you for your call, Laura. Now, Mark, thanks to yourself, another Talk Radio listener has come forward who is looking after a partner. And this is Robert. And Robert has sent me a brief email, which I'll read out, about his situation. He says, "My name is Robert, and I am a full-time carer for my wife, who has dementia. Her decline has accelerated over the last couple of years, and at present she no longer knows my name and does not remember or recognise her family. She's unable to take care of herself, can no longer cook, make drinks, nor other important tasks that we all take for granted. We've been married for 27 years. I'm committed and dedicated in doing all I'm able to do to take care of her and provide a safe and secure home, as I know she would for me if our places were reversed." Robert goes on, "My wife, as she was such a kind, loving, intelligent and strong person with a fantastic sense of humour. This condition is stealthy and creeps up unseen for a long time. The first signs of a problem, in our case, were forgetfulness, the sort of thing that happens to everyone. Then there was a sign that I did not understand the meaning of at the time. She was driving, and she asked me if we should turn left or right. I said which direction we should take, and she turned the wheel the opposite way. She'd forgotten left from right. Later," Robert goes on, "the family had a big row. An argument that was settled flared up again as my wife didn't remember what was said before. Those members of the family became estranged in the end, and as time has gone on, the reality is, in life, sometimes there's no second chance to make up. The person my wife was is gone. And some wounds can never be healed. Only the deepest regret remains. There was a point," Robert continues, "I never knew, when she went from 100% healthy, and then a tipping point was silently reached, as if one day my wife left me. And I never saw her leave. I never heard the door close. These days, to keep my wife safe, I have locks on some doors, such as the kitchen door, to keep knives, gas taps and so on out of reach. I also need to keep the house locked. Two or three times before, my wife has gone out and become lost and frightened. Kind neighbours took care of her and alerted me. I've had to take down mirrors, as she had begun to have blazing rows with the reflection. The TV was broken after another row when she punched the screen to hit the presenter. In other circumstances," Robert goes on, "things like that might be funny. But when it's our reality, it's utterly sad." Robert finishes by saying, "As carers for dementia sufferers know, it's a long, drawn-out heartbreak. Even when there is a diagnosis, there's nothing you can do to halt the decline. I feel like her hand was held up from the water where she was sinking, and I could not reach it to pull her to safety. These are my feelings. I don't wish to reflect on anyone else. We all do our best in our own way. There have been so many tears, so many reminders of our loss. I used to perform as a lifelong musician," he says. "I've given all of that up, and my life is now dedicated to my wife's care. That was hard to come to terms with. but infinitely harder was, after all our years together, we've rolled up our hopes and dreams for a better future and put them away as a keepsake. I won't ever give up on my wife, but I know and understand one day that she will need to be in a formal nursing environment. I know that, and I know the staff are excellent at the possible home near us. But the guilt of that action is something I dread. One final thought. My wife never knew that she had this awful condition, and for that I am grateful. These are some of my feelings tied to this illness. Robert finishes by saying much love to all who might share them. Good night. Well, thank you for that, Robert, from the bottom of our heart. That was a very insightful email into your wife's circumstance, and one which resonates, obviously, with Mark, who is with us in the studio, another Talk Radio listener who is helping with his mother's dementia. If it's something that affects you, you can call 0344 499 1000 or you can text 87222, start your message with the word talk. It's Tommy Boyd in for Ian Lee. And in this part of the programme, we are talking about the challenges faced by people who are looking after people who are dealing with dementia. Ken's on the line from Newcastle. Good evening, Ken.
Good evening, Tommy, and good evening, Mark. This is the most difficult disease to deal with. I've got quite a few instances in my life. My brother-in-law, sadly, he died with it. Before he died, his life consisted of just following his wife around throughout the home. Very sad. I've got a friend I used to play football with a long time ago, for many years. And I met him when I was up in Scotland a few months ago, and he didn't even remember me. I used to go to the football matches together with him. And I had a friend, and we'd friends in Canada, Native Indians in Canada, and they asked us to go, and my wife and I, to go and visit their father who was in hospital. And all he did, very sadly, was curse and swear, and he was never like that before he had the Alzheimer's. But I would just like to suggest something. This is, I think, perhaps a very hard, well, it is extremely hard to deal with, and you can only you would know, Mark and Tommy, you both dealt with it much more than me. But I would just like to add in something here to encourage people who are going through this. Try Jesus. Read the Bible, the Gospel of St. John, and ask God to help you in the situation you're in your life. That's what I would like to pass on, because God knows our hearts. He knows our troubles. He knows the situations in our lives. He knows how we think. And to deal with this problem, to try and do it in your own, would be very, very difficult. So all I'm suggesting as a Christian is to try Jesus. Don't try religion. Try Jesus. Start to pray to Jesus and just talk to Jesus about the situation. And then let Jesus speak to you in his word if you'll read the Bible. The Gospel of St. John, just one chapter a night maybe, and pray and ask God to help you understand his word and understand his love for you and the one who's ill. So that's all I'm suggesting. Don't try religion. Try the person of Jesus. Call upon his name. Ask for help. Tell him your troubles and trust in him to help you. That's all I would like to suggest, and that's up to each individual to try Jesus, the Saviour of mankind.
Okay, Ken, nice one.
Tonight.
Thanks for your call. Bye. Ken's a regular caller, and he's much cherished. It's very difficult for him not to bring it all back to our Lord and Maker. Were you religious, Mark?
No, not really.
Your mum?
I don't think she was.
Mark's with us because he's a Talk Radio listener who alerted me to the fact that another listener whose email we've just read out, I hope you managed to catch that, it was extremely moving and insightful, was dealing with a difficult situation at home and would appreciate an email, which I sent him. And it struck me that if you've got two dedicated Talk Radio fans who are dealing with the same problem, then there might be tens of thousands, and the issue that they're dealing with, the thing that Mark and Robert are dealing with, is looking after, completely untrained. You haven't been trained or
no.
you haven't been given any professional
no.
advice in how to do the job. You probably know some things about your mother's condition that are not known to a great many professionals because you're there with it all the time, seeing
yeah.
it, watching it unfold.
Yeah, absolutely. I do get good advice from the Alzheimer's Society. They have navigators who will visit you and get to know your circumstances, and then they'll be assigned to your household, and they'll come along whenever you need them, or they're there on the end of the phone for support, and I found that invaluable. There is support out there. There's not as much as I think people think. And I think
if you can bring yourself to ask for it,
yeah,
isn't that the case? They will not come knocking on your door.
No, and I think that there has to be acceptance that you need the support and the help and the understanding. And I think if you try to do it all on your own, and I take my hat off to anyone who does and pulls that off, it's incredibly difficult. I couldn't imagine what that's like. But as friends and family understand, and they understand that what they see on the TV doesn't necessarily apply to my mother, and that there are unique circumstances to everyone who's suffering this, and indeed any terminal illness or an illness that will eventually claim them if something else doesn't. It's just dealing with it. But it's also making the most of what you do have and not feeling sorry for yourself. And I try not to.
Mark is here. He is a talk radio listener whose mum is declining with a dementia. Is it Alzheimer's?
Early onset Alzheimer's.
And we're talking about this issue from the point of view of just the ordinary person who is living under the same roof as or visiting the home of a relative or perhaps a friend or a partner who is dealing with dementia. Telephone number is 0344 499 1000. Or you can text us if you can squeeze it into a text. More likely, we'll try and call you to get your story live, or maybe advise you how you can get us an email, which is what Robert did, which was a bit old-fashioned, I know, emails, but a very appropriate way of explaining just what it is like in his particular set of circumstances. That text number is 87222, start your message with the word talk. I'm Tommy Boyd in for Ian Lee. This is Talk Radio.
Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Alzheimer's and the other dementias, of which there are a great many, but the other dementias apparently only contribute something like 30% of the number of people that are known to be dealing with dementias. Alzheimer's covers something like 70% of the cases. I was listening to a podcast about memory and what it is, Mark. And, of course, they don't know, really, I say they, so-called experts, really know very little yet. I think that with the mind, my own view, is that with the human mind, we're about where we were 300 or 400 years ago with general physical medical understanding. And we'd only just discovered that blood actually circulates around the body then. Mm. Now, it's not that long ago. But I think that we are at a similarly early, or perhaps I could say primitive, stage of understanding what the mind is and how it functions. And, of course, that very important thing, which is, where are we in all of it? Are we our brain? Are we our mind? Or is there something which, no doubt, our last caller, Ken in Newcastle, would argue very strongly, are we in fact some kind of immortal soul that is not located in the brain? In which case, I would have asked Ken if I'd wanted the argument when he was proposing that people with dementia and those looking after people with dementia should turn to Jesus, whether a person's soul is still with them. This would be the Christian thing. In fact, if anybody listening has a view on this, I'd be quite happy to hear what it is, because it's intriguing and it is not in any way facetious. If we have an immortal soul that is destined either for hell or heaven, which is my understanding of one of the key planks of Christianity and several other religions, Is that soul still located in the individual when that individual no longer knows their own name? And let me ask you, Mark, it's a difficult question off the top of my head, but I'm going to anyway because it intrigues me. Does your mother's moral compass appear to be as sound as it was before the dementia arrived?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really? How interesting.
Yeah, she still absolutely has a very good understanding of right and wrong. The moral barometer is absolutely there. In fact, I was having a bit of an argument with her partner a few days ago about something. He wasn't listening to an essential bit of information regarding a care plan. And it dragged on and I needed to get my message across. And I lost my patience and I swore, as he was. And this stuff happens. I mean, this is just the mess that you navigate that I mentioned earlier. I'm absolutely no saint. You know, I try to exercise patience and understanding. I try to take that away from conversations about care, money and so on, away from earshot of my mother, which I think is very important because that can further the agitation and the anxiety. On this occasion, it just came out in the room. Stuff happens. And my mother just said, stop the swearing. It's not right. Talk calmly. Now, that's not necessarily an indication of moral kind of one's moral compass.
No.
But stuff on the TV, she, you know, there are moments of surprise and insight and incisiveness that I treasure. So yes, she does. Her soul, her understanding of herself and where she's at is there. Do I worry whether that will slip away and fade away? Mm. Eventually, yes. And that's probably one of the hardest things to accept, that that may happen.
03444991000 is the number if you want to talk about any experience you have of looking after somebody with dementia, which it might be something that you're doing at the moment. I was listening to a podcast about memory, and I learned that what little is known about memory is as follows. It's suspected that there are two types of memory. One is called episodic memory, and the other is called, I think, semantic memory. And with an episodic memory, it's something that you remember because of a sequence of facts or information. So if I ask you listening, what's the very first thing you can remember? You'll probably say something like, oh, I can remember playing in the garden, the sun was out, the birds were tweeting, and I could smell the Sunday roast, and I was going to be called in soon to eat. And most people have that quality of memory of their first memory because of all the sequences and the little collection of episodes that surround it. So it's a bit like a, you know, who, where and when set of memories. And you keep them together like that because of all the interconnected things and the significance of it. So that's episodic memory. And we've all got tons of those going way back. And hopefully we've got episodic memories of things that we did 5 minutes ago, such as put sugar in our tea. Then there's something called semantic memory, which is where we don't remember where we were when we learned, for example, at school that Paris is the capital of France. Because it's not a particularly significant thing. And nobody's ever asked us where we were when we discovered that Paris was the capital of France. And yet, we can all remember that Paris is the capital of France. Of course, it's been reinforced plenty of times by discovering that, or having it being reminded that Paris is the capital of France on, you know, various occasions. But that's what's called a semantic piece of memory. But what was really interesting in this podcast was as follows. They did some experiments with an individual who had had a large part of his brain removed to try and alleviate the epileptic fits that he was dealing with. And as a result of that operation, he couldn't remember anything that happened after the operation. So he could be shown something or told something for the rest of his life and he would never remember any of it, not for a second. But they tried to teach him some skills. And one of the skills was mirror writing, where you hold up a mirror and you ask somebody to duplicate what it is that they can see in the mirror. So they're writing backwards. And it's a particular skill. And it's not something you can achieve straight away. You have to work at it. And this individual was able to develop that skill and improve his ability to right using a mirror, even though he didn't have any actual memory of the previous occasion when he'd practiced the skill or been taught the skill. So all of that was kind of interesting, but in an unconnected way. And I was just left, having listened to all of that, just marvelling at how little we know about the thing that is most likely to turn out to be us, which is our mind and our memory and the way in which we process information. Let's hope to God that there is indeed an immortal soul in all of us and that it wings its way to everlasting happiness in heaven. That would be fantastic. Unfortunately, I can't persuade myself that it's the case. Right? So I'm stuck with the idea that I am my thinking, my memory, my processing of the now, my processing of the past, and bringing those things together to help me make decisions and to understand and appreciate the present and do a little bit of planning for the future. And that is what I think I am. Now, in your mum's case, Mark, that's started to unravel 5 or 6 years ago. And she started to forget things. And what you're saying is that she noticed it before anybody else did. And now she's even less aware of things that are going on around her. Is she even less happier than she was when she began to suspect that she was carrying Alzheimer's?
She's aware of quite a lot around her. It's processing what that means. The semantic side, she's aware of what's happening. It's how she interprets it. And I think she's about as happy as I could possibly expect her to be. Okay. I wouldn't say happy. I'd say comfortable.
Okay, one last question then to you. It must have occurred to you, because we are discovering increasingly that our future can be predicted in terms of our health, by what has gone before us, by what's happened to our parents and our uncles and aunts and grandparents, do you now find yourself necessarily wondering if it might be around the corner for you?
I would be lying if I said I hadn't been concerned about it at some stage early on in this journey, but through what I've read and understood, I believe that lifestyle, nutrition, and I'm talking with the caveat that it's probably not familial, so genetically I may be unlikely to be predisposed to get it, if that makes sense. Knowing that I can control what I eat, my lifestyle, my diet, my state of mind, and all of that to a great degree, I don't worry, because I want to live my life as much as I can, and there's no point. But in the back of your head, you think, you know, it could happen, and if it happened, I prepare and deal with it as best as I could.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much indeed for what you do, and love to your mum.
Thank you.
And the same goes to Robert. Love to Robert, who emailed us with his circumstance, looking after his partner, who, as he said so eloquently and so movingly, has gone, has walked out the door, but he is still looking after her in what must be very harrowing and lonely circumstances. So, Robert, thanks again for that, and love to you, and love to your partner. This is Tommy Boyd in for Ian Lee. One feels a semi-professional need to lighten the mood or raise one's spirits if you've been listening to our conversation about the challenges facing people who are looking after people who have dementia. It's very thought-provoking. And I'm going to choose to find it uplifting, because the people who are doing this are quite inspirational, and heroism takes a great many forms, and a great many heroes are quite rightly celebrated in the Western world and around the world for the dangers that they face professionally. It's good to also celebrate the heroism of people who are doing something apparently nothing less mundane than looking after mum or looking after their other half. 0344 499 1000 is the telephone number. Text 87222. Start your message with the word talk. I'm Tommy Boyd, in for Ian Lee. This is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB. The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment. For those about to talk, we salute you.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
It's just after midnight, so it's October the 2nd, 2017. Welcome to the only October the 2nd, 2017, there'll ever be. Carpe diem and all that calf.
Absolutely. Actually, it's October the 3rd, but...
Oh, yeah? Oh, OK.
Only just.
Well, I've decided that it's a really interesting place to be, standing in for Ian Lee, with what is often the most enjoyable part of a programme in front of us, the last hour. Because it's intimate and there's nobody else listening. But I've got nothing on my mind at the moment. And I'm really cool about that.
Mm-hmm.
I've got nothing that I want to get off my chest.
Enjoy that moment.
I hope it lasts.
Yeah.
It's not to say that, you know, I've got necessarily a sweet disposition. What happens is that I find myself going, well, perhaps I don't care anymore. Perhaps I've realised that getting worried about Donald Trump or ISIS or, you know, Liverpool's shaky defence just isn't going to get me anywhere. So I'm going to watch a lot more afternoon TV.
Isn't that called controlling the controllables?
I didn't know there was a term for it.
Yeah.
Let's take a few calls. 0344 499 1000. I'll say that again in 2 minutes' time, a bit more slowly, if you're new to Talk Radio, or if you're listening on your laptop whilst you're messing around on Facebook, which I gather is quite a common thing. Let's go to Cleo, who's in County Down. Hi, Cleo.
County Durham.
County Durham. Did I say County Down?
You did, you little thing. You thought I was Wolford, didn't you?
Now, that's funny you should say. That's almost weird. What made you say that?
Because Wilford was from County Down, wasn't he?
Well, it's just that, you know how funny things are like that. I'm going to detain you with this. Mark, who was with us in the last hour talking about dementia, commented on a caller that we had, a man called Ken from Newcastle.
Oh, God.
And I said, you know, he reminds me of somebody called something or other. I can't remember his name, who used to call from County Down.
That was Wilford, yeah.
Yeah, and then 2 minutes later, you come on. I mistake you for being from County Down. And the first thing you say is, who do you think I am, Wilfred? Mm. Now, seriously, is that coincidence?
I think it might be, because you already had County Down in your head.
Yeah, but when I say County Down to most people, they don't say, who do you think I am, Wilfred?
But I am an avid Tommy Boyd fan, so I remember people like Wilfred and his...
Better than I did.
And his libido. He was a randy old goat, wasn't he?
I don't know. I don't think... See, my point is, I don't think Wilfred was real. I think some callers to radio phone-in programmes are not real. I think that they are Bob Mortimer.
Sometimes,
well,
yeah.
Well, I'm not really Cleo. That's my nickname, as christened by Ian Lee.
Okay.
My name's Lane, and we've spoken many, many, many moons ago.
Right. You and I have.
Yes.
Okay.
About various things, including getting drunk with Peter O'Toole.
Getting drunk with Peter O'Toole.
Yes. But anyway, that was the past. We've discussed that. The self... The mind.
No. You can't move swiftly on getting drunk with Peter O'Toole without
getting
actually...
getting more drunk with Peter O'Toole.
Well, tell me. Remind me. I don't remember ever talking to anybody who's got drunk with Peter O'Toole.
You were talking about a horse racing.
Yes.
And it stuck in my head, someone you also used to discuss a lot, Jeffrey Bernard...
Is unwell, yes.
Yes. Well, I got drunk with Peter O'Toole while he was playing Jeffrey Bernard.
Nice.
We did a thing called the Circle Line with my friends down in London.
Yes.
Where you get on one station go to the next one, get off, find a pub or a bar, even if it's at the station, neck a couple of pints, get back on the tube.
What, round the whole Circle Line?
Well, my Christ, I think we've got about a third of the way around, we're nearly dead.
You see, that reminds me of the great one where Peter O'Toole and Richard Harris went out drinking, and a police officer found Richard Harris lying face down in the gutter at about 2:30 in the morning. And he said to Richard Harris, allegedly, "What are you doing there, down there, sir?" And Richard Harris is said to have replied to the police officer, "I've read that the earth revolves every 24 hours, so I'm waiting here for my home to come past." Oh, if only it was true.
Well, anyhow, that was mainly mates.
Yes.
And then we were going to go clubbing that night, so it was decided that I would go back to my friend's flat and get changed. And I was too drunk to move. I didn't know.
Yes.
There's no way I'm traveling. We had to go all the way back to Stafford East or something like that. And I was like, I'm not going that far on the tube. I can't do it again. I said, I'll just walk it off. So I'm going to make myself feel a bit better for later on. And I walked for a bit. And it was sort of Christmas Eve. You know that period when, I think it's usually around about five o'clock, you get like half an hour where there's like nobody about.
Yes.
People like, it's like that little period between people running to and from work to get ready to go out that night. Well, it was like that. And I ended up in Soho. And I went to the Coach and Horses.
The Coach and Horses!
Yes.
Down on both knees, all of us.
Yeah, man.
The Coach and Horses. You're barred!
But he wasn't in. Norman wasn't in.
Norman.
But there was a Geordie lad behind the bar, and he clocked the accent.
Yes.
He's like, "What are you doing down here, lad?" And I was like, "Oh, class, a welcoming voice." Well, I'm just out with my mates, we're going out clubbing and all that stuff. And there was an old guy in the corner, sort of, on his own, wearing a lovely white suit. He looked dapper, but he was on his own, and he was so lanky. You know when people, you sometimes see this with drummers, they'll sit on a stool, and their knees are almost touching the chin, they're that lanky.
Yes.
Well, he looked like that. You see his knees? That's the first thing I remember. And then he went, I went to the barman. I was, do I know him? Because I just recognised him as he hadn't the clue where from. He goes, "Why, it's Peter. You'll know Peter." And I was like, "Peter, I hadn't a clue." And I went, "Shit, that's Peter O'Toole." And I went, "Peter O'Toole." He goes, "Hi. And he just went, "Young man!" And I'm going to swear at you, you can get the dumb button. No, I'll replace
it. I don't know what you said, so I can't. Should I dump it? I don't know what you said.
He said he's going
I'm
to, gonna, so
I'm
going to
say it in a second.
Okay.
Well, why don't you not say it and just substitute it for something that's not going to require dumping?
Yes, much better.
I'll make my own beep.
Go on, then.
Another beeping Geordie, are we? That's what he shouted.
Yes.
And I went, "He's shouting at me?" And the barman was like, "He's talking to you, you know." I was like, "Oh, God, it's Peter O'Toole." I didn't have a clue what to say, and I felt like a right plonker. And I was half cut still. I hadn't really walked it off. And I went down to the seat near the main doors, and he was just sat there. And he was slowly getting mizzled, a little bit drunk, and went, "Take a seat, not a drink." I was like, "Aye, please, well, you guys are drinking." He just shouted, "Same again," and the lad brought it over. And we just got talking, but it was just about, life stuff. He was asking what I was doing down there.
Yes.
It wasn't like... I remember thinking, don't mention any of the films, because you've heard this, a million times before, and you didn't want a fanboy. But I did.
Shrewd, if I may say so. Very shrewd. The way to ingratiate yourself with Hollywood superstars is not to mention anything about their work. Just stick to talking about beer and what the parking's like. They love it.
I failed slightly for a bit. And he ignored it. I went, "You were Mint Lawrence of Arabia."
Did you say that? Did you really say that? You must have cursed yourself the minute it came out. Mind you, I would.
As it was coming out, I was like, what am I doing?
He likes your lemonade.
Yes.
Take an Acrobar, Lawrence? Who has? We have our side in this bloody war. Hell of a movie.
But I must have been there for about only maybe 40 minutes or so. I got even more drunk.
What was he drinking? Everything.
Just shots. Don't know what the shots were.
No.
But this is the killer. He went, right, I'm off to work. See you tomorrow to the farm. And then I was like, you're off to work? Went, yes. Goodbye. And I was like, what the hell? And he was off to work. I was like, he's acting like that. He's mortal drunk.
So he got himself completely hammered and then went off and did...
Jeffrey Bernard is unwell. I've since bought the DVD.
Have you got the DVD? The whole thing?
I've since bought the DVD.
Go on, then you do the Den-Den story. Den-Den?
Den-Den.
With John the Measurer. Working Den-Den?
The one about the police?
No, because that's got a lot of swearing in the punchline. You can't do that one.
I can't remember anything without...
No, don't say it.
Yeah.
All right, listen, Cleo, great to talk to you. Really five-star, mate.
Well, I didn't get to speak about the self and the brain, which is why I rang, but...
Go on, then.
These things happen. Well, anyhow, because 3 years ago on a Sunday, I died.
You died?
I did. For 3 whole Earth minutes.
Did you really?
I did. Kath knows about this. I've bleated on about it before in the past.
Oh, OK.
But...
I'll ask her, then.
Yeah, ever
take
since,
shorter.
You probably tell it better than you.
Yeah.
Go on, Cleo, what happened?
I thought I was having a heart attack. I didn't. It was pneumonia. And I remember going into A&E. I can't remember anything after that until waking up. And I was convinced I was on a UFO because I was off me gourd on whatever meds they gave us.
Sorry, you were on a UFO?
I was convinced I was because I was off me...
And right, you thought you'd been abducted? Okay.
I was having my head on whatever drugs were giving us.
Yes.
And there was, lights beeping, and I knew I wasn't breathing for myself. So I was like, yay, I've been abducted. Anyway, that's by the by. What is, I forgot. When I woke up, I forgot the previous 24 hours to me going in. Because apparently, when I first went in, I was there for 24 hours. Then I took really bad and had to be rushed into ICU, and that's when I died. But, okay.
And when you were dead, do you recall any shining lights at the end of tunnels or choir of angels or...?
Do you know when you hear nurses say, on films and so forth, just speak to them because you can hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
I could.
Yeah.
But I couldn't hear... I can remember moods. So I remember when people were down.
Yes.
And I can remember feeling, oh, this is my friends, not my family. Because my family were generally down.
All right. Listen, Cleo, I'm really grateful for your call. I've got a stack, so I'm going to love you and leave you, but... You call again any time you like. We're talking about X, Y and Z, aren't we, Kath, basically?
Certainly, yeah.
Which I think is what, you know, midnight until 1 o'clock is very much all about. People might be listening in bed or listening on down the wrong end of a bottle of wine or something, or on their laptop, messing with Facebook and things like that. So it doesn't have to be, you know, pounding radio. The number is 03444991000. You can text 87222, start your message with the word talk. Kath, have we been getting tweets and texts and things?
The odd one. Let me show you on there where you can read them if you want to read them.
Oh, yeah, I'd like that. While you're coming around and showing me that, stay where you are, Kyle, who's mobile, who is coming up after Rob, and stay where you are, Ari in Gateshead, because you're after Kyle. Rob, hi.
Tommy, hello.
Hello. Yeah, never been better. Thank you. How are you?
I'm okay, thanks, mate. How are you?
Yeah, well.
Good. I used to listen to you a long time ago when you were on talk radio back in, late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah, Scotchism.
Scotchism. Scotchism. Yeah, fantastic broadcaster.
He was a good guy. What happened to him?
I think he's basically responsible for Nick Clegg being the Deputy Prime Minister, because Scott has a... I'm told Scott Chisholm set up a company advising people on how to improve their media image, and one of his clients was Nick Clegg.
Oh,
so
right.
Next time I meet Scott, and I will meet Scott again, he's one of those people. He's a good Antipodean. You don't have to be in touch with Scott to meet him again and just kind of pick up where you left off, because he's a real proper bloke.
Proper bloke, yeah.
He said to me once, you know, I've looked at my physical characteristics, and my tail of the tape suggests that I'm bigger and stronger than Mike Tyson. And do you know what? He bloody was. Scott Chisholm, he's a big lad. You wouldn't argue with him, although somebody did once. And he knocked them across the newscaster's desk. That was how he came to move sideways from television journalism into radio journalism. top man, Scott Chisholm. Thanks for the memory.
Yeah. I used to love that. I was a student when I used to listen to you. He's absolutely love you. But I just wonder where your politics are nowadays, because I'm sort of... I don't know where I am with politics nowadays. I voted Theresa May in the last election, and I'm sort of looking at her now and thinking, she's useless, isn't she? And I'm thinking, Bojo is a bit of a character.
My politics, if you're asking, and you are, aren't you?
I am.
My politics are as follows. It's what I call if you know anything about football...
I know a bit about football, yeah. I live in Southampton, so I follow Southampton, but I watch much of the day, you know.
Right. Well, my politics suffer from what I call the Everton syndrome.
Okay.
And it's this. You will never meet an Everton fan whose father wasn't an Everton fan before him. Ever.
Well, that's a good thing.
You will meet some Everton fans whose brother... pretends that he supports Liverpool just for the argument, but
right.
Being an Evertonian is genetic.
Are you an Evertonian?
No, I'm not an Evertonian. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, I am the son of an ardent, and I mean one of the most ardent, communists this country's ever known.
Yeah.
Such a communist was my dad that after the war, the fool... He got on a motorbike and he motorbiked all the way across Europe until he got to the Berlin Wall, and he knocked on the door and asked if he could come in. The fool. He did. He absolutely did. I've seen his diary. And they said, Nicht, nein, no, this is not how you defect. So he went, right, okay, if you're not going to let me in, I will take my defection elsewhere. So he motorbiked down the entire length of the Iron Curtain, turning left every time he saw a customs point and said, can I come in? He was a Geordie lad. He said, can I come in, Lake? I agree with all you're doing, like, you know, all that sort of commonness and love and everything. And they went, no, not here, mate. And he got all the way down to Switzerland. I forget which door he was knocking on there. And he gave up. But when I was a boy, we had a life-size cutout of Stalin hanging in the cupboard under the stairs.
Really?
And that's going to affect you. That's going to affect you.
So well, my old man's from Middlesbrough, and he was a teacher, and he was very, very left-wing. And I could never, ever think about voting Conservative. The first time I voted Conservative was when I was, 40 years old, which was 2 years ago. I voted for Theresa May. And I never had the guts to tell my dad I voted Conservative. And now he's a big Jeremy Corbyn fan.
Okay.
And I'm sort of thinking, Jeremy Corbyn is quite attractive to me, even as a 40-year-old man with a house and a decent job, etc. I can't help thinking Jeremy Corbyn is someone I would quite happily vote for. I live in the South.
Yes, I have to say, though, that whatever my political persuasions are, one thing I've discovered is that having a laugh with arch Tories... is more fun than having a laugh with any other arch type of person, because the sort of absolute, the quest for integrity and absolute, I don't know, some sort of political perfection is rather a killjoy in people. You know, it sort of sours, a liberal conscience can sort of sour you a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, whereas people who don't have that kind of liberal consciousness, they know how to have a bloody good time. And more than that, about my own politics, I will not say. I think I've been actually quite diplomatic there, haven't I, Kath?
I think so.
I think so. Rob, thanks for your call. I've got a queue, so I'm going to look forward to the next time I talk to you.
Thank you, too.
Good man. Tommy Boyd in for Ian Lee. Kath is here. I've just discovered tweets and Twitters and things. Yeah. I didn't realise they were available on a screen, so maybe I can get you to do some of them when they...
Sure, OK. When we come... got them over here. That's
Oh, haven't you? Okay, well,
I could
we'll
sit in there and
up.
Do him. I'll do that.
All right, then. Okay. When we come rushing back, he clichéd. Tommy Boyd in for Ian Lee on Talk Radio.
The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Starting at 10 o'clock, we talked a little bit about the conference season, the party conference season, the fantastic sleight of hand by which Jeremy Corbyn has managed to persuade a great many people in the United Kingdom that it's all the fault of capitalism, when he himself is the most shining example of the capitalist entrepreneurial pitch and sell that I think is out there at the moment, right now, today, in our country. Brilliant. In the middle hour of the programme, between 11 and 12, we changed the tack slightly. And we talked about, and I'm going to use the word, celebrated the people who are looking after people who are dealing with dementia. They are a real army of unsung 21st century heroes. And in the last hour of the programme now, we're just settling down a little bit because it's nice and late and it's nice and intimate. And so I shan't be jumping on any soapboxes or machine gunning anybody in this hour of the programme. Oh, God, that was a stupid thing to say, but you know kind of what I mean. Shoots himself in the foot. Not shoots himself in the foot. Move on. idiot. Kath's got one or two texts and tweets that
have
flooded in.
Yeah, your conversation with Mark has prompted quite a lot of people to come forward with their experiences. One of them is this one, and no name on this, but it says, I work with a colleague who's just lost his mother and father within a month of each other, and he was sharing the care duties for his dad, who, the last 18 to 24 months of his life, with dementia, Alzheimer's, and from what he's been saying to us, and visibly showing, has been like a roller coaster of emotion and physical strain on not only him but the rest of the family. He's had, in my opinion, a very close call to a breakdown, and from what he said, his sister almost had a breakdown as well, just through the difficulty of caring for the father. His dad worked all his life and ended it in such a terrible way, it was making the fellow I was working with go from a very positive person to, at times, a very dark moments and massive strains on his family and work. He said the whole process was a learning experience and the support you get is very limited unless you really push for things to be put in place. We've also had this one through from Yorick.
That was a good listen.
Yeah, yeah. Yorick the Rolick says, powerful, powerful stuff on Talk Radio right now. Tommy Boyd's playing a blinder. Here's one. Hi, Tommy and Mark. This is from Marcus. I, like all your listeners, I'd like them to make one promise to themselves and to their families. Never, ever say, I'd never put my relatives in a care home. You're not entitled to say that unless you've been through the experience of looking after a relative with dementia. My mother was my grandmother's full-time carer when she was in the early moderate stages of dementia. It was absolutely exhausting for her, and in the end she made herself ill. We had no choice but to put my grandmother in a home. The carers there worked an 8-10 hour shift, then went home. It's an impossible job to do 24/7. Best wishes from Marcus. There we go. Let's see what else we've got here. Lots of people saying that that it's nice to hear you back. I just wanted to say I think it's great to hear Tommy back as an original Talk Radio listener from back in the day. Hope Ian's all right too. He's absolutely fine. He's having a lovely time.
Excellent.
Yeah, so it's people are glad to hear from you. And also, you know, the experience that Mark and yourself were discussing has really hit home with a lot of people.
Okay. Thank you, Kath. It's 87222 if you want to text the programme. You can tweet at Talk Radio. Or you can call 0344 499 1000. That's what Kyle's done. Thanks for your patience, Kyle.
No, it's all right. Good evening, Tommy. Good evening, Catherine.
Catherine's on her way between the gallery and the studio, so
Oh, no, no. It's fine. Well, I was going to say.
Just a second.
Oh, thank you. I was going to say, I was ringing to actually ask you a wrestling question. But the thing about the care is difficult, it was, and I spoke to Ian and Catherine before about it, I think 2 years ago.
she passed away, but about 12 months before that, she was in sheltered accommodation, and she kept having falls, and, you know, and it was the hardest thing I've ever had to do, was sort of say, well, you know, you need to go into a care home, really, and it was just that, and having that conversation, it was just, I don't wish anyone to go through that. It's awful. Awful.
It is. It is. My mum ended her days in a care home. She was very well looked after. I think one of the big difficulties that I had during her last time, and I didn't do most of the looking after of my mum, one of my brothers did that, because he doesn't have family, but I do, and so I was sort of looking after my family as well as doing what I could for my mum. But you get a phone call from a doctor saying, are you prepared to agree to what's called end-of-life care?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, when you see what that means, that a person is simply allowed to die with dignity and no great intrusive, invasive attempts are made to extend that person's life by an hour or a day or what have you. It's still quite a thing. And I've still got the photograph on my mobile phone of my mum lying quite peacefully at rest. But I couldn't be sure that she didn't know I was in the room. So I talked to her, and it was obviously one of the most difficult conversations I've ever had. I talked to her softly and slowly, in case there was a possibility that she could hear me and understand me. And that was the last time I ever spoke to my mum. The last thing that my mum ever said to me that was her, if you know what I mean, was...
Mm-hmm.
She said, I was driving her to the hospital, and she said, what day of the week is it? I said, it's Saturday, Mum, why? She said, oh, because they always ask you that. And I thought, that's really interesting. She doesn't know what day of the week it is, but she can remember that she's going to be asked what day of the week is it, and she wants to she wants to fool them.
I remember a similar thing with my grandma. Who's the Prime Minister? What day is it? Why is that? Oh, because they're going to try and trick me, she said.
Yes. Yes.
She said, and sometimes you just can't think.
Apparently, who is the Prime Minister is a question that's often asked.
Yeah, what day is it?
I did that. Sorry.
Yeah, go on, you go, Carl.
I was going to say, and I said, I will save my wrestling question for later in the week, but I said before, I think you were at the room, Catherine, that I've spoke to you and Ian about it, but when I had my health issue, that was one of the daily things he used to come and ask me in the hospital. It's like, what month are we in, who's the Prime Minister? And that was the one that I struggled with. And it was difficult to try and recall that, because two out of three I could get straight off. The third one I struggled with, and it was just horrible.
I wonder if that, it depends where that's hidden, which part of the brain it's in.
Yeah.
Because you had a stroke, didn't you, Kyle?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
So maybe they're testing for a certain area of the brain, whether that's working, or maybe it's just as simple as let's find out whether he knows, you know.
Well, now that they're able to light up the brain whilst it's doing things, they're getting closer and closer, aren't they, to knowing which bit does what, which bit controls which bit. I'll tell you an interesting thing that I discovered myself. You know, the brain consists of nerve cells, and also each nerve cell's got this long tail.
Yes.
What's it called, a synapse or something?
Synapse, yeah.
Thank you. Right. Well, I worked out how big the nerve cell is compared to the synapse. So this is what I worked out, and I worked it out myself, so it's definitely true, right? But I've not seen it written down anywhere else.
Right, okay.
If a nerve cell, Kath, was the size of you, right, 5.5 foot?
Yeah.
Okay. How long do you think your little nerve cell tail going off you would be?
Oh.
Ah.
Would it be, I don't know, I'm guessing, what, 3 times as long?
3 times as long. Can you imagine having a tail 15 feet long?
Yeah.
Longer than that.
Oh.
Yeah. How long do you reckon, Carl?
Well, I'm just trying to think. Catherine said, did you say 3 foot, Catherine?
She reckons 3 feet.
3 times
as long as...
5 foot 6.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was 20, but I imagine it's all coiled up.
Right, are you sitting down? I hope you are, because this will make you go, what? You ready?
Okay.
If Kath, at 5.5 feet, was the size of a nerve cell,
mm-hmm.
her synapse tail would be about 30 miles long.
Incredible.
It would stretch from Liverpool to Manchester. That is how big the synapse is.
Gosh.
And that is why, because it's the synapse lighting up and making a connection with another synapse that leads to another brain cell. Supposing you've got a memory of Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
And you think of Amy Winehouse, and it's connected with a night when you actually watched her do that performance where she was falling over a lot in France.
Mm-hmm.
Then, because your Amy Winehouse synapse lights up, and it touches so many other synapses, right? Then you think to yourself, oh, and then there was that night when she fell over in the river when she was performing in France.
Gosh.
That's how it works. It's as simple as that.
I read a really interesting book. Ruby Wax has become a PhD or something, hasn't she? She's done a lot of work in and research into mental health problems.
Right.
And she's uncovered this theory. I'm sure it's not her own original theory, but she writes about it in her book, and it's fascinating. If you can get beyond the very technical stuff at the start, it's really interesting, that you can kind of fray those connections.
Yes.
And that's what leads to problems and descent into mental ill health, is that, you know, extreme stress, extreme anxiety.
Yes.
Every time you do that, you kind of shoot your synapses and you put too much stress on it. They start to disconnect.
Or... Yeah, go on, you go next, Carl.
No, I was going to say, the strange thing is I had a conversation with somebody on the phone last night, or telephone, I was going to say, and he was asking me to do something coming up in February, and we were talking about this event or whatever, and he was referring to a third person, and he said, you met him at my 50th, which was about, and I was like, I don't recall it. I have literally no recollection of this event. And he was explaining it to me, and he was like, but you were there, and this is who you came with, and this is who you got a lift home with. I've absolutely no... And this morning, I spoke to the other person in the conversation, and then it took him a bit, sort of, and he was like, oh, no, hang on a minute. No, we did do that. I did give you a lift there and back. Do you not remember it? And I was like, no. And that's something. Some things, I absolutely, like a photograph I recall... But somebody's 50th birthday, even now, I can't bring it to mind like a photograph.
Were you
told I was there?
Were you staggering drunk though?
No, actually, I wasn't. No, it was because I think I had like 2 pints of bitter or whatever. But it was really weird. Even now, because that's the way that I can bring things. I can normally put a picture to it in my mind,
yes.
But I can't bring any pictures back to that evening. I can't. It's like a gap.
What you're drifting towards here is something that, again, I heard another podcast about, which is what's called false memory.
Yes.
And what they do, if they want to give you a false memory, is they get some information about you. Might be something that happened to you at, say, a birthday party when you were 7.
Okay.
And they'll go, and you were there with your school friends... Bob and Peter and Martha and Alice, and you'll go, yeah, I remember that, yeah. And you played Blind Man's Buff, yeah, oh, I remember that, yeah, yeah. And Pin the Tail on the Donkey, yeah. And it was shortly after that that the police came. And you'll go, no, I don't remember that. Go, oh, yeah, yeah. The police came because somebody had thrown a bottle through the window and it was you. And... You go, no, I didn't. I don't remember that. Ah, no, well, you did. You did. I can understand why you choose not to remember it, but you did. Now, what was it I was reading? Why do they do this? This has got something to do with training people who are interrogating people into not giving people false memories, because that would be wrong and unfair of them. So... That they've come across or devised this way of providing people with false memories in order to make sure that, particularly when police are interviewing people, they don't accidentally, inadvertently give them false memories of crimes that they didn't commit, but might end up wondering whether they did, because they're given the information about the crime, which they didn't know, enmeshed in other material that they do remember.
And that's going to be particularly powerful at a time when you're under stress anyway, and yeah, you're desperately trying to remember things.
Yes.
Gosh.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
It is. It is. Carl, I'm really grateful for your call. Will you call again, please? And
yeah, no worries.
We'll do the wrestling thing.
All right, thank you. Cheers, Elf. Bye. Bye.
It's Talk Radio. I'm Tommy Boyd. I'm looking after the show whilst Ian Lee is away. Feet up? Has he got his feet up, I presume?
Or has he gone to the party? Yes, he has. He's gone to Marrakesh.
Oh, right. I thought you were say he's gone to Manchester like Julia Hartley Brewer.
No, no, no. He's mooching around in a Panama hat.
Fantastic. Well, so's she, I hear. the telephone number is 0344 499 1000. Women look so good in men's hats. Why is that? They do. Trilbies. Yeah. John Betjeman wrote a whole poem about how distractingly good-looking this woman was wearing a trilby hat. I think it was called O Photography or something like that. Anyway, I'm drifting here. Text 87222. Start your message with the word talk. This is Talk Radio.
The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
I had Peter O'Toole, no, we didn't have Peter O'Toole on earlier. We had somebody who'd met Peter O'Toole in the legendary Coach and Horses in Soho earlier, and someone called Lane has tweeted, this is annoying, you're now talking about the very thing I wanted to discuss, not O'Toole again. Ha ha ha.
Oh well, there's another day, Lane.
Did you ever watch Frasier, the programme about a man who's got his own radio programme?
Yes.
With Kelsey Grammer.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great episodes is when Patrick Stewart, as in Star Trek, plays an opera director who Frasier becomes slightly infatuated with, and it turns out that the opera director played by Patrick Stewart is gay and kind of offers Frasier a gay relationship, and Frasier is tempted to say yes because he just wants to be
so fantastic.
Part of what he calls a power couple. It's not ideal, he says. but there's a great line in it where he comes around to the flat that Frasier lives in with this English physiotherapist who helps his father called Daphne.
Oh, yes, I know. She talks very like that, doesn't she?
And Patrick Stewart invites them all to a party, a grand party. And as he's going out the door, Daphne says to him in that Manchester accent, "Oh, will Peter O'Toole be there?" And Patrick Stewart's got this great reply with his voice, which is just, "No, and he knows why." It's just a fabulous fake line. Tommy Boy, this is annoying. You're now talking about... Oh, there. Girls can never look good in pink cowboy hats, says... Indy. Heady? Heady. Girls can never look good in pink cowboy hats. What? German officer hats? Those tiny top hats and fedora are all good.
Girls look good. Very specific requirements.
Girls look good in cowboy hats.
Well, and pink cowboy hats. I mean, don't...
God, yes, with rhinestones.
Beautiful. I think if you're going to wear a hat, wear a hat.
And white cowboy boots.
Why not?
I'm not going any further down this road, actually, except to say... What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. I think stop drinking in October is a great idea.
Stoptober.
Stoptober.
I could do with maybe having a dry
But out. Being a realistic person, I think we should also... harness for charitable purposes what we're going to do in December.
Right.
Which is go to lots of parties.
Mm, so?
And imbibe.
Yeah.
So what about somebody gets hold of the idea of tithing, so that if you go out to an office party or Christmas lunch or, you know, just go down the pub with your mates on a Friday and you agree that you're going to give 10% of everything that you spend on alcohol to that charity... It would be a really good idea. I'd be interested in doing that.
It would be good. If you could keep tabs on your spending, of course.
I've got a catchy name for it.
Go on.
I can't remember December.
Beautiful.
See, we're nearly there, aren't we? We've got the strap and we've got the charity connection.
Yeah. We just need to harness it.
Harness it. Ari's called from Gateshead. Ari, good evening to you. Good morning, whatever.
Good evening, Tommy. How are you?
I am spifflicating. How about you?
I realise. same. Just want to tell you about what you said about your mum, that she, according to how we believe, I'm Jewish, that she definitely heard you.
Okay.
Now, I know that you're quite reluctant to listen to anyone with these sort of views, but if you give me half a minute and then tell me if it makes sense at the end, you don't have to believe in it.
Sure, yeah.
Right, basically, they've done research about people who had near-to-death experiences. Now, I'm not sure what your previous caller was on about, but I have read quite a few stories from people who were either related to the person or very good friends. One was with a woman who had to have a very, very dangerous operation. It was a brain operation, and she had to be, her body had to sort of be frozen and have all the blood pumped out of her so that she can survive when it gets pumped back into her and then warmed up to the right temperature and then pumped back into her. And she survived the operation, and afterwards she asked a certain nurse, "Why were you holding a toothbrush next to me?" And that nurse turned white, and she said, "How do you know about this?" So she said, "Well, I saw you holding a toothbrush next to me." So this nurse said to her, "It was this tool which she saw holding was a highly delicate surgeon's knife, which looks very like a toothbrush. But the only way you could have known that is if there is actually something called a soul or something out of this world." Now, according to what we believe is, when a person dies, it's as if me coming into a room and taking off a coat. I'm still me. I still have the same feelings. I still have the same compulsions. I still do the same stuff.
I respect that, but I do want to say that if I have a soul, it will know the difference between a toothbrush and a scalpel. I hope.
That's
especially
not true.
If I brush three times a day.
Okay, let me ask you a different question.
Yeah, that's an accident waiting to happen. You can see that right there.
That's true. Let me ask you a different question. If you had put on an astronaut's suit, would you become an astronaut?
Well, no, not for the putting on of the suit. No.
Right, because you in your essence, and I'm talking now about your body and your soul, you in your essence will not change when you put on a certain type of clothing.
Yes. No, I've got all this. I am not what it says on my debit card. I'm with that. I've got that.
Right.
I'm in here. I agree with that. I've got that. I am not this thing that you see if you meet me. I am inside it. I am looking out through a pillar box style slit in the top. There is something in here that is me.
So therefore, when your mother died,
yes,
obviously, her soul, well, we believe her soul is still there till 30 days after.
So do the Buddhists.
The body.
It's really interesting that. So do the Buddhists. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Oh.
No.
It's a very prescriptive time.
What's that?
30 days.
The same reason
it's the same in, it's the same, it's the same with the Jews and the Buddhists.
Right.
Agree on that one, but they don't know that they agree on it. Because neither lot ever bother to look at what the other lot have got to say.
Hmm.
That's the problem, isn't it, Harry?
Well, if I believe in my religion, why should I try to believe in anyone else's?
That's a really stupid question. I hope you don't honestly think that somebody who's intelligent enough to ring my programme and talk to me, you can't possibly pretend to be as stupid as that.
Whatever you say.
You can't possibly pretend that you believe.
If I believe.
Just because you're Jewish, you shouldn't find out about Buddhism.
No, I didn't mean it in that way.
Ah, okay.
I meant that if I believe that my religion is true and I feel that it's true,
yes,
then I should be studying, I should be praying, I should be living my own life.
Yes.
My interest doesn't have to include Buddhism.
Yes, it does.
Why?
Of course it does. Because it might be more true for you than being a Jew. It might be. You don't know until you found out.
I do know because I found out.
No, you haven't, because you don't know anything about Buddhism.
Right, but if I believe...
So you don't know that it might be better for you.
I feel that my religion is true, and my religion...
You've got nothing to compare it with.
Okay.
I think that you're really a Buddhist, Ari.
Have you tried every single religion in
yes,
the world?
Yes, absolutely.
Honestly?
Everyone.
Honestly?
Totally.
You've gone to every single
absolutely.
Corner.
I've read the Quran. I have studied Buddhism, not just Hinayana Buddhism, but Upper and Lower Mahayana
what
Buddhism.
Have you tried about Judaism?
Sorry?
So what have you tried about Judaism?
Well, the last time I was in Israel, I was impressed with a great many aspects of Judaism, which I found very similar to Christianity, Islam. Certain traits I found in Buddhism.
So you're not happy about it?
Confucius, Taoism.
What does that
Shinto's
mean?
A good one. I quite like Shinto. And then, of course, there are the other religions.
You know
agnosticism
more...
and atheism.
You know more religions than I know my... Don't ask.
I know. I know that. You have to. You have to. It's such an important thing. Ari, we run out of time. So let's continue this conversation. I will persuade you. I will convert you to Buddhism. I promise you by the end of the week.
Well, if you don't believe in Buddhism, then...
All right. I've got to go because we've got time and all that sort of thing. Kath, thanks for an interesting show. And thanks to Mark and to Robert as well.
Pleasure. It's been fun.
Pick up again tomorrow night around about 10 o'clock?
Sure, why not?
Beautiful. This is Talk Radio.